than all different classes of shares, it's akin to saying something like, oh, well, two people got killed in a car accident last night, we need to ban all cars. Cars perform a very useful function in society, and the same goes for this incentive. Okay, so where to from here? We can't simply remove the proposals and just carry on as before. The abuse is going to continue, and that will ultimately affect the sustainability of the incentive and create revenue pressures elsewhere. We also can't simply promulgate the proposals that are currently formulated. The effect will essentially be that the incentive will be dead. So it's as good as not having the incentive. And all of those jobs that have been created, all of that economic growth, is we could throw that out the window. So what PwC is advising is that we just need a little bit of clarification on what the policy is and what the underlying policy is. What do we not like? What do we like? And how do we draft rules around that? I think a lot of the issue is the incentive is put together based on the assumption that it's a pooled model. In other words, you have a pool of passive investors and a pool of target investments. You know, the design of the incentive is such that it's based on that. We perhaps need to look at, the Treasury should perhaps look at incorporating some kind of non-pooled approach where there can be legitimate uses of different classes of shares and there's an ask for it. Policy is that different classes of shares is not policy, but it's not always illegitimate. We also need to identify what the schemes are and introduce the appropriate measures, specifically targeting abuse schemes. Okay, I'm going to run through the rest of the stuff quite quickly. Tax treatment of collective investment schemes. Here the proposal is that we strongly recommend that this proposal be withdrawn completely. It's ill-considered. In short, it's going to lead to a severe long-term impact on investment saving. The introductions, just if I could just have one more minute around this. There's still a lot of lack of clarity around exactly how the rules are going to operate. Can I suggest the Treasury just please just have a look at those rules and clear it up now. We really, you know, really the rules came in last year and we had a lot of uncertainty. We hate that to continue. I think a lot of work has been done and we're very thankful for that. But we'd like to just have it completely finished and put to bed now. I'm going to wrap up my time now because I think I've run out of time. I think the most important thing is that we've hit our... If I could just say the real estate investment...
It's only given 5 minutes.
The real estate investment trust. Look, it's not part of the current round of... There were minor amendments dealing with this, but not in the areas that we need some attention. There are a lot of technical problems affecting the efficient operation of the scheme. And resolving these issues would not involve a lot of policy... wouldn't involve any policy decisions, and that'd be pretty easy to address. The regime has been around for six years now, and we still have teething problems around the implementation. Now, the signal that sends to investors is South Africa is not friendly towards investment, and it's not very accommodative. It's actually not a huge thing, but it has a massive effect on investment. With that, I'll round up my presentation. Thanks very much for the indulgence.
Well, if we spend a minute later, maybe we'll give you an opportunity to finish off. Do we have Seiko?
I'm just waiting for the co-presenter who's been delayed at the end, so it should be another 15 minutes.
I apologize for that. We're trying to get our staff to address that, to get our people through. So, we have some boys there to try and get them through.
People are saying they're all going to meetings, so they're not giving each other a chance because all of them are late for their meeting.
There are three machines broken there, so it's slowing everything down. Well, if I may just finish
no,
one
more. Too much traffic. That is a yes. No, before you, that's a yes. Are you ready to present? not received a presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Thabo Khujani, and on behalf of the Association for Savings and Investments SA, ASISA, we thank you, Madam Chair, and honourable members of the Standing Committee on Finance for this opportunity to make a short oral submission on what is a significant proposal contained in the 2018 draft taxation laws amendment bill. The draft TLAB proposes a major change in tax policy for collective investment schemes, also known as unit trusts. The proposal is that short-term capital gains should be deemed to be income of a revenue nature and be taxable as such. We as ASISA are concerned that the lack of consultation on what is a very significant tax amendment has meant that there are, in our view, a number of both harmful and unintended consequences that could result from the change. The first unintended consequence is that local unit trusts could become far less attractive for savings, in particular discretionary savings. And this would occur as a consequence of two things. The first is that virtually no other country in the world taxes unit trusts in the way that is proposed. Therefore, the proposed change, we believe, could encourage investors to externalize their saving to foreign unit trusts that are not taxed in the manner that is proposed. Two, the unit trust manager will be obliged to distribute all short-term capital gains. So in addition to what is currently distributed in the form of interest and dividends, capital would also be distributed. And we know that based on our experience and observance of human behavior, we know that many investors, if not most, would not reinvest those distributions. And if these two things become a reality, in our view, there could be a significant negative impact on savings, particularly domestic savings. And our view is that we as a nation should be encouraging savings and not discouraging savings. We have seen reduced levels of savings by households for decades. If you go back to the mid-1990s, personal savings rates were in excess of 6%. And for the majority of the past decade, those savings rates have been sitting in negative territory. In direct opposition to that trend of declining savings, with unit trusts, what we've seen is that millions of South Africans have gained access to financial markets through what is essentially a very well-regulated, safe, transparent, and cost-effective vehicle. Unit trusts are widely held. They're held by individuals as well as by retirement funds. And while the proposed amendment might not necessarily result in lower savings, our firm view is that there would be some externalization of those savings to foreign jurisdictions. The second unintended consequence is a lack of fairness. And I've given two examples in the submission. I'll cover one of them. The first example is where you have an investor who invests into a unit trust shortly before there's a distribution. And it is possible, and it will happen, that this investor will ultimately pay tax on gains that they were not part of, that they did not experience as an investor in that fund. There's a third unintended consequence in our view, which is we think a permanent reduction in the long-term returns that are enjoyed by individual investors as well as retirement funds. Historically, unit trust portfolio managers have one focus and one objective, and that is to generate long-term sustainable returns that are real, that are ahead of inflation. And in our view, introducing the requirement of tax optimization for these unit trust portfolio managers will necessarily mean that they can no longer evaluate their investment decisions purely based on merit. A typical example will be a portfolio manager who holds on to a share for much longer than what they think they should be holding on to that share for. And there's a fourth possible unintended consequence in our view. It is likely that the liquidity of our financial markets would be impacted. Unit trust savings total approximately 2.3 trillion rand. And so in our view, they are systemically significant. And the introduction of what is effectively a higher tax for short-term capital gains will introduce a lock-in effect. And the lock-in effect, we think, will result in distortion of asset prices. We have employed the services of an actuary, an independent actuary, to help us model transactions in the industry and hopefully arrive at some sort of quantitative impact assessment. Unfortunately, we have not had sufficient time as of yet to complete this work. In closing, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, we as a CISA request that the amendment to Section 25BA of the Income Tax Act should be withdrawn. This would allow us time to work with National Treasury and the FSCA to investigate ways to address the original problem observed by National Treasury, which is the frequent trading in unit trusts. In this regard, we have already made a submission to the Davis Tax Committee last year that a technical committee consisting of all the stakeholders, National Treasury, the regulator, FSCA, SARS, and ourselves as a CISA should be convened to develop some solutions to this question. In our view, we would be able to identify targeted interventions that would not have the negative unintended consequences that I've covered and would not slow down what has been fantastic growth for our savings pool in general and in particular our domestic savings pool. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. What a good example. On record time, 10 minutes. I hope others will follow his example. I don't know whether Saika is still here or should we proceed to the text? Okay, let's. No, it will be after the discussion because we are taking the text from the person. Members, we don't have the presentation. You'll speak to the submission that's in your bag. So there's no television.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Honourable Members. Thank you very much for this opportunity to make this proposal or presentation. Back about 2 years ago, the tax ombud made a proposal to be able to initiate a systemic investigation. That was followed by page. That obviously was approved, but there were ways that were inserted in under section 16.1b. And to read that briefly, it says that the mandate of the tax ombud is to, among other things, to review at the request of the minister or at the initiative of the tax ombud with the approval of the minister. And these are the ways that we propose are creating a problem. The tax ombud can only initiate with the approval of the minister. So any issue that ombud wants to investigate, which is a systemic issue, he has to approach the minister for approval. So one of the difficulties with that is that when we established the office, we realized that we needed to do some benchmarking, and we looked at the various jurisdictions, and Canada is one of them where this legislation that deals with the powers of the ombud are largely imported from. And we found that there are no such ways. Best international best practice allows the ombud to initiate, conduct a systemic investigations on his own initiative with no prior approval from anybody. Now, we looked at Australia. Similarly, the Inspector General of Taxation has similar powers, but with no requirement to obtain approval or ministerial approval. Similarly, in the U.S., the same thing. So these ways are problematic in one way or another. And so we were proposing that these ways be deleted. The ombud should be able to initiate an investigation without drawing the minister into administrative aspects of the office itself. Because by so doing, you have to really do a thorough motivation to tell the minister exactly what the issue is and how it must be investigated and the like. And I must just stress one thing. And the ombud himself, Judge Bennett Webb, is very concerned about this ways, this specific ways, because practically, at the moment, a request was made about 7 or 8 weeks ago, or two requests were made, and he said, I must emphasize this to Madam Chair, that he is concerned that he makes a request 6, 7 weeks later or 8 weeks later, there's still no response. So in a way,
don't make a big issue out of it for now, please.
For whatever reason, the problem is that we are faced with taxpayers who are bringing issues to us, and for us to be able to do a thorough investigation, we have to wait until such time as the minister gives the approval. So in the absence of that, the taxpayers are looking at us, this is a toothless dog, no teeth, nothing, can only bark and the like. So taxpayers need to have confidence.
We never equate human beings to dogs. To animals in particular.
I will withdraw that, Madam Chair. These are the ways that are used by taxpayers when they refer to us, unfortunately. But in a nutshell, and I don't want to labor this point or drag it, we just propose that the ways with the approval of the minister be deleted from this specific section so the ombud can freely conduct his work. After all, The ombud it reports to the minister. So if the minister feels that perhaps there's an abuse of the process, he may stop the ombud. Say, the ombud, you're really now taking it too far. So there are enough safeguards in terms of the reporting line. And in a nutshell, that's briefly our submission.
Thank you. 5 minutes has been saved.
Is Faiko ready? Thank you very much, Chair. Just getting into it, most of the detail is contained in the detailed submission, so we won't deal with that. We'll leave that to the committee members to then go through. We'll look at five items specifically. One was not necessarily in the bill, but we thought we'd raise it given the matter that was long outstanding. Okay, the matter that we want to cover first is on diesel rebate and VAT set-off. And in essence, Chair, I think the point we're trying to make here is there seems to be an anomaly where currently in practice we're setting off diesel rebates, which is a customs issue against VAT. However, due to delays in, be it audit, etc., of the customs, because two separate systems, it is resulting in VAT disputes. In other words, the system is then picking up that rebate as a VAT underpayment, which results in double disputes, the one obviously being quite unnecessary. And I think we either need to amend the practical side, namely the form, or alternatively amend the law to allow for the set-off in that regard. The second matter, just on the tax practitioner regulation, I think it is quite welcome that we have this as part of, call it, an ethics framework within the tax profession, and to that extent it has been proposed that tax compliance of tax practitioners form part of the regulation model, including for regulated controlling bodies or RCBs. The problems that we have raised with this is just twofold. I think the one in essence is that we're just seeking a fair procedure when this happens, so the sanction essentially for this is deregistration. And for non-compliance, is that non-compliance be subject to a procedure that's not just systems-driven, but people-driven, given some of the challenges with things like journal entries and historical matters coming up, so that the compliance profile not necessarily be used as the only mechanism. The second is that there seems to be no mechanism that when this deregistration happens, the tax practitioner's clients, so if this person has 500 clients, where do they go? Do they get notified? Do they get an opportunity to find a new tax practitioner? So there seems to be no mechanism to actually deal with that element once this deregistration of a tax practitioner happens due to the tax practitioner's own non-compliance. I'll then hand over to my colleague David Warnicker.
Madam Chair, so I'll look at the Section 7C extension that we've got in the bill, starting with that. The provisions that we had that were introduced in last year's bill widened the scope of Section 7C too far. It went too far. And it appears that we've got a proposed amendment which on the face of it seems to be attempting to solve that problem, but we don't believe that it actually does solve the problem, and in fact it actually makes it even worse. So the current situation that we've got in the Act as it stands before the amendments, the basic problem is that there doesn't have to be any shareholding connection directly between the trust and the company in question. So if you've got a trust and you've got a beneficiary of the trust who happens to have shares in a company that's not directly related to the trust, a loan by that person to the company will trigger, or could trigger, Section 7C. So that's the basic problem that we've got at the moment. We also don't have guidance as to the terms, what exactly is meant by when a loan would be made considered to be at the instance of a person, which would bring in Section 7C for loans at the instance of a person, which could lead to the situation that loans going between two companies below the trust could potentially be hit by Section 7C as well. So what we suggest is that the proposal should explicitly require a shareholding at some level by the trust in the company, not jointly together with a connected person or a beneficiary, but there must, the trust must hold at least one share in the company to trigger the provision. And also, the one should count the shareholding of a beneficiary in relation to the trust, not a connected person in relation to the trust, because that extends it even much wider. The definition of connected person in relation to a trust is very wide. It includes any person that's connected to a beneficiary. So for example, if a relative of a beneficiary of the trust had a shareholding in the company, that would be sufficient to trigger Section 7C. And then we also need guidance on the interpretation of the terms at the instance of a person, when is a loan considered to be at the instance of a person, and also preferably the words directly or indirectly. The collective investment scheme proposal will be dealt with by, has already been dealt with by CISA, so I won't spend very long on it, but just to say that the CIS, it's mainly for long-term investment by the vast majority of investors in these vehicles in the economy, and one mustn't lose sight of that. And so the proposal is to deem receipts from disposals to be income if disposed of within 12 months by the CIS, irrespective of the fact that the investor in the CIS would normally have a long-term intention with regard to their disposal. So, one finds that the vast majority of short-term disposals aren't triggered because of speculation. They're actually triggered as a result of having to rebalance the portfolio, for instance, to track an index, and also just because of effective management of the portfolio. So it's not because the portfolio manager is speculating that these 12-month disposals could be triggered, and we don't seem to have, as has already been mentioned, a similar tax practice in any other markets or any other jurisdictions. So what we're saying is that this proposal should be withdrawn in its current form, because it doesn't actually, it's not going to really level the playing field, we don't think. In fact, it's going to discourage investment in this very important form of savings. If there's a concern around specific CISs that have been formed by particular small pools of investors, maybe to circumvent the legislation in some way, that should be addressed separately. But one shouldn't really penalise the vast majority of investors in this important sector because of the behaviour of one or two small players. And then lastly, with regard to dividend stripping, we found that the override of the corporate restructuring rules by these dividend stripping proposals that was introduced in last year's legislation has been hugely problematic for legitimate transactions, and a lot of them have ground to a halt. So what we believe is that the proposals should be corrected, that this override should be corrected retrospectively to when these penal provisions were introduced in last year's legislation. So it should be corrected going back to when the problematic legislation was introduced last year in the first place. There's also, this has led to very, very complex legislation. It's almost unreadable in its current form. And in particular, there's a high value company scheme that seems to be addressed in the current proposals. And it doesn't appear to make commercial sense for rational investors to, in the first place, go into such a scheme. So we would prefer that particular part to be deleted. But that there should be an overall simplification of the provision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of the first presentation by this group, Honourable Members. let me say this upfront, we're in a quagmire. You see, we don't have an actuary to tell us whether what has been presented by the people here is basically an analysis to go with. So we're going to use our own discretion to look at matters that relate to investment. So it's going to be a very interesting discussion going forward. And I hope you'll stay with us as we battle to deal with matters like cracking indices. Because we don't crack indices here in Parliament. So, okay, let me first allow members to ask questions, to make comments before we take response. Can I have an indication, Honourable Members? Honourable Lee? Is that only him? Okay, I'll be after him since there's no taker. Okay, may you proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just go through in the same order, Erica. I'll start with you. You make a point about the notification to taxpayers, and I think that your words used, the taxpayer should know what is required. In your opinion, is the correspondence that currently gets generated by SARS, apparently in English, understandable by any layman? Because I don't understand it. I got a letter a week ago which is just gobbledygook, I'm afraid. So what is your impression? So it's, the point I'm making is that it's all very well to insist on correspondence or letting people know, but it's the content that is vitally important, and I'd be interested to know what your clients, your members, experiences. The doubtful debt provision, the phasing in, I just need you to expand on that a little bit. I'm not sure that I fully understand, but I think I do, if you could expand on that a bit. What are the unintended consequences on the VAT on cryptocurrency? Perhaps I missed it. And then the last one on the provisional tax, the triggering of registration if there's a capital gain. Is it not true that the registration and the provision submission of a return are two different things? In other words, if I don't request an IRP 6, I don't necessarily do a return, although I'm registered as a provisional taxpayer. I'm not understanding how serious that problem really is. PwC, I think we've heard quite a lot about the VCCs and CISs. I didn't hear any real on the VCC any concrete proposals about how to deal with it, after our policy and so on. And then I'm very keen to hear about the foreign employment income section that you didn't get to. If you could explain that, it was very controversial last year. And I would like to hear if there's further issues there. Asisa, I'm not sure where you're sitting, but I thought your presentation covered it very well, and so I'm not leaving you out because I didn't understand what you said. I understood it far too well, and so. Thank you very much for that proposal, for that presentation. Tax Ombuds, that was an issue, but at least we got the provision in last year. This year we'll perfect it a little bit more and see if we can get those words removed. Peter, nice to see you again. I'm sorry that our hospitality was so bad that you got here so late, but I'm sure Madam Chair has already apologised for that. So, please just explain to me a little bit more about this set off and diesel rebate versus VAT. I mean, they've been on one VAT 201 submission for a long time, wrongly so, I think, because they are separate systems. But I just need some explanation there. You're pleading for your members to not be machine-driven in their termination, but the jolly taxpayer is machine-driven. Millions of taxpayers get these, and the younger is now glaring at me, these dreadful letters of gobbledygook, and it's all machine-driven. You can't speak to a person in SARS. You try that call centre, and if you get through, you're lucky, and if you actually get someone who can understand what you're talking about, you're even more lucky. So I think that I agree with you, but surely that's something that should be more applicable to taxpayers as well as to tax practitioners. The point about the 7C extension is certainly, I think, valid, so I won't ask more there. You talked about problems in the dividend stripping legislation or changes, but you didn't give me any, or perhaps I wasn't listening. I do fall asleep sometimes, but what are examples of those problems? And the Madam Chair probably would tell you that I'm asleep most of the time, but then she has her own agenda. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Honourable Masango.
Thank you, Chairperson, and also appreciate the questions from Honourable Mazamba. They helped me a lot. And I'm not a tax specialist like he is, but I understand this is the hearing and we still have to discuss what has been presented to us as a committee. I'll only raise one thing that I need more clarity on for me to understand, so that when we go to discussion, I'm convinced on the tax combat. The only thing that you emphasize is the deletion of section 16, subsection 1A, with the approval of the minister. And I had an interest on this one. When you were presenting, you said you don't believe that the minister must be more involved in administrative issues. And you further on your presentation give us examples, information about your consultation with other countries, what you have learned, Australia, Canada, and stuff. But, Chair, I'm not agreeing, I'm not disagreeing. I just want to be convinced and have an understanding. What is the disadvantage? What will be the impact? So that when I take a decision or make a contribution, when we make decisions, I make an informed contribution. What is the impact actually about the approval of the minister if we maintain the 16.1B, the pros and cons of maintaining that? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Any other member? Okay, let's in the absence of any comments, can I make comments and ask questions? Honourable members, actually, first my observations are that the sector is organised around five areas, very organised. It's like they had a private meeting engaged and say, let's speak on these five areas. That's a comment, I'm not saying you did. It looks like you did. You're very organised around those issues. And one of the interesting things, which I thought I was going to hear suggestions, it's on the role of VCCs and how shared classes is going to affect Afisa makes a very interesting argument about savings reductions. But I want us to internalize tax avoidance and in tax collection, because one of the things that we do through TALAP and TLEP is to make sure that there's efficiency in tax collection, and it's juxtaposed against tax avoidance. There will always be creativity by the institution to try at all costs not to pay taxes. So part of the things that the system will pick up, it will be creativity of business to try and pay as little tax as possible. And one of the interesting things is how shared classes have been put, but also how capital gains has been allocated to short-term venture. And I think this matter is the matter that all of us must respond to and say, in an event that a company needs to look or needs to pay tax to capital gains tax but has ventured into short-term approaches to avoid that, what then becomes the immediate response by the South African Revenue Service? It's a question that we have not put for ourselves. And one of the things that Saika says is that we need to find ways to circumvent investor behavior. But the question is how? How do you do that without putting an unintended consequence? The argument remains between who should be a shareholder and a beneficiary at the same time. In collective investment. Those are the issues that we need to, all of us here, come with solutions. There's no shortcut to it. But I become worried, younger, when Afisa says there's not been consultation, because that's the first question I will ask, or that Eunice would have asked if he was here, that was there sufficient consultation to try and convince one another that in the manner in which one moving will be able to reach consensus. The other matter relates to how systemic financial institutions are juxtaposed to financial service providers in terms of incentives. The 25% matter and the 40% matter. It's an issue that at some point we'll have to engage. Because any FSP that is not a deposit taker is not expected to have a certain amount of liquidity. As if it's a prerequisite, it's part of the regulations. So we'll have to come to that argument, lift it up, because I did not hear in the presentation how people say our liquidity should be the same as the bank on the basis of 1, 2, 3. Because an ordinary FSP does not necessarily provide the same amount of cash to even its clientele. What you will get from PEP stores and what you get from a bank will never be the same. And I'm not arguing for either or. I'm saying let's lift up those issues and be able to relate to them. In terms of unit trust, I'm talking to Asisa. I want to understand your arguments properly so that I put it in perspective. You argue that what National Treasury is doing is tax optimization on the basis that if they continue to do it in the manner in which they do, it will lead to externalities where investments will be offshore. Now, I want us to understand that argument as to how does a situation where something that's supposed to be long-term is now performing in the short-term can lead to external factors. maybe there's an argument there. I'll have to understand it. PwC says we might want to redesign our incentive scheme, but you should not make a specific proposal. I can't see the gentleman. So I'll be interested if you give more meat to this suggestion, because to me it becomes a concrete suggestion about how you redesign your incentive schemes to be able to not lead to an unintended consequence of a take-up and not necessarily investment. Because the argument that has been raised here is that when this incentive was introduced, the intention was to make sure that small business comes into the picture. But you see it's a circle of investment within the people who have benefited from the scheme. And really, let's talk about morality in business. Because that's, and I know it's very difficult to regulate morality through a law, because that, I don't think that was even the intention of SARS, to regulate morality. But in the South African context, and I want to argue it based on the facts that Afisa raises, if you have billions of brands circulating in business and you get less than 30% of small business benefiting when actually the incentive was designed to benefit that, are we saying we are moral enough to say that we're locking out small business and not letting it participate in the economy? It means they will never grow. And who is small business, by the way? Let's go there. I can take it further and say, let's look at the face of small business and let's look at the face of big business. I don't want to go there, because then it's another argument about financial sector transformation, which we've closed, we've agreed how we're going to proceed. So I want us to answer, all of us, how are we going to ensure that small business is also a taker and this incentive scheme does not benefit same people in the same manner, and saying it because it's not illegal, therefore we cannot. Because if we have a different way of allowing people to participate fairly, surely there would be no need for regulations and the law to kick in. But the fact that we find ourselves together in this room today discussing legislation is because there's never been fair play for quite some time, for years actually. Leave alone color, just the level of engagement between business has led to a point where government had to intervene through regulation. So I think we need to speak to these issues for us to be able to. But there's a good suggestion that comes that says, and it's a sister that says, that speaks to action. We need an impact analysis at some point, Bianca, that will assist us to come to a point where we deal with this issue. But the immediate one that you might want to look at is this diesel rebate. It's maybe it's an issue that you might want to internalize to look at what the sector is raising. Also, the issue that Saeed is raising about when you deregister a practitioner, what happens to the client? It's also an issue that we might want to respond to and address also how Section 7C and its extension, well, some argue it's got a wider scope, some argue differently. But the issue of how investment schemes are looked at as cracking index, I need to be convinced. See? Here I hear a typical investor speaking about looking at the books and the performance and not looking at the total picture of the impact of them. It might be a valid argument. Maybe it needs to be explained further, and then we deal with it at some point. But to me, having listened to all of you, it was a very interesting argument that has been raised. The tax umbas person, that one we deal with at a different level, I think, at some point. not necessarily true. So if we involve the Davis Tax Committee, it's going to be another money that the National Treasury must extend the mandate of the Davis Tax Committee. I don't know whether what are we going to, unless the private sector says we'll pay for that, then for now I can't say much about that without getting into trouble with taxpayers. They don't want the 1% VAT already. So I don't know how we'll pay Judge Davis on this one. So can we maybe, when we go forward, we'll look at these issues. But let's allow, how much time do we have, Alan, for the responses? Yes, we have already lost 15 minutes, so we'll allocate half an hour if people are easy. That will be fine for us, just the special person. We'll start with you, Karen.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Lee, the question whether SARS correspondence is understandable gives me an opportunity to say that one of our recommendations was specifically that this new notification that you are being audited must be called a notification of audit, so that it says what it is. At the moment it's called an engagement letter, and like we said in our work group, what does it mean? Does it mean I can choose whether or not I'd like to go ahead with this? That's a little bit of a tongue in the cheek. But I think... So we do feel that you must say exactly what you're doing. In terms of whether this correspondence is understandable, I think at the moment we get correspondence, for example, at the moment SARS is sending our Section 12L energy efficiency audit letters, saying, please give me these 16 things. And they started with saying, who at Saneri audited your, or gave you your tax certificate, who on your side asked for the tax certificate, etc. Things that the law already says you can just rely on a tax certificate because Saneri is an accredited body. So in a sense, it's already not understandable because you do not understand why they ask those 16 questions when the tax certificate, in terms of the law, should be fully relied upon, and Saneri would have gone through those tests to determine whether you are actually entitled to the allowance. So I think generally speaking, taxpayers also find that they get standard letters. When you submit your individual tax return and you get a letter saying, send me all your documents, that is improving, I hear, or will be improving. So it has undertaken to now start sending you a specific request. But those things are known to happen. In terms of the doubtful debt phasing in, at the moment, as a taxpayer, you could have a situation where you look at your list of debtors and say you've got, call it, 100,000 Rand worth of debtors, and you could specifically identify which of those debtors you regard as being bad. And maybe you say, I think, you know, I'm in a highly risky industry, I expect 40,000 of those debts to go bad. So you could claim 40,000 Rand as a doubtful debt allowance. From now on, if the proposal goes through, you will only be able to claim 100,000 times 25%. So that's 25,000. So in the first year, you basically have to claim 15,000 Rand less than what we would have been able to claim had you just carried on the same basis. And that would mean that you would have to pay the tax on 15,000 Rand more in the first year. That is a cash flow impact. A doubtful debt allowance is an allowance. So you get it this year, they take it back next year, they give you a new reassessed allowance the following year. But if you've always been claiming at more or less the same level, it stays more or less the same. And if you now move from 40,000 to 25,000, it could be a big cash impact. I don't know if that answers the question.
Madam Chair, it does answer the question, but I'm not sure I agree.
She doesn't agree, okay.
Okay. Obviously, with the phasing in, we mean that you say that an impact you phase in over 3 years or whatever. Recently, when the banks moved on to a different dispensation, that's what they, you know, managed to agree with Treasury. The VAT on the cryptocurrency, This is a very difficult and technical one, and initially when you look at the proposal to treat it as an exempt supply because it's a financial service, it sounds as if there would just be nothing that would happen if you pay it with cryptocurrency. But if a retailer, say for example Pick and Pay, were to accept cryptocurrency as tender or for payment, it will build up a pool of cryptocurrency which it then in turn would have to dispose of in the market to get money for that. And when it does that, it will actually be making an exempt supply, and if you make an exempt supply, you can't claim all your input tax, and then they will have a leakage of input tax, which you would not expect a retailer to have. So that is one of the unintended consequences. We really think that there must be international precedent that can be looked at in this regard. Just before I hand over to my label, I'll answer maybe also to some of the other points. I think it's a very good question, Madam Chair, in relation to the avoidance that is taking place. One wouldn't know what the extent of the impact is, but there would be an impact on tax collection. And, you know, I think taxpayers and people who come up with schemes will always come up with schemes. And like somebody said to me with a venture capital companies, because there is an upfront deduction of 100% of the amount that you invest, it was just a matter of time before people started abusing it, you know. So that is maybe a bit of a fatal flaw in that regime. But generally speaking, there will always be these clever people, and I think one of our problems in South Africa is that it's very hard for SARS to actually use anti-avoidance legislation to effectively address the anti-avoidance. And therefore, I think it's often left up to Treasury to find a way to actually address the anti-avoidance through legislation. But then I think it's very important that you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And then I'll hand over to my label to answer the question about the provisional tax registration if you've made a capital gain.
So, provisional tax, like the other tax cycles, provisional tax, like the other tax types, if you've met the requirement, then you would obviously have to register to be a provisional taxpayer. Now, in terms of the return, you don't necessarily always have to be requesting the return in order for it to be due. So if in that particular year of assessment, for example, you've made the taxable capital gain and you obviously make the registration and you submit the return for that specific capital gain, in the next year of assessment, even if you don't request the return but because you're registered, that return would then be due. So obviously if you don't then submit the return, there's all sorts of penalties for non-submissions of the return. So that it's sort of practically how it would work, and some of the challenges then for taxpayers who wouldn't necessarily understand that, and that after they've registered they would have to go back and deregister then to no longer be required to submit that return.
So in the process it's cumbersome?
Yes.
Okay. Any further takers? Peter,
yes, just to address Honourable Lees and also your questions, Honourable Chair. I think, you know, as Erica said just now, I think the central problem with the venture capital company regime is that it does give you an upfront deduction right at the beginning. That is something that is contrary to normal established principles, that run through our entire tax regime and our entire tax system. That being said, I think it doesn't detract from the fact that it's an incredibly valuable incentive, and it has the potential to create a lot of growth and a lot of a lot of jobs. But obviously the abuse does need to be countered and does need to be controlled. Now, the question then arises as to exactly how that abuse is controlled. I think it's so difficult, it's a problem with our tax system in general, is that we tend to, as tax advisors, and I count myself as one of them, is that we look at the rules and we look at the words and what the words say. As long as we're in the words, we're okay. I think we need to move towards more of a substantive kind of a purposive approach to interpretation. That being said, it's unlikely that that's going to happen in the near future, so what do we do in the meantime? And you know, aside from saying that we need to be clear on exactly what is abusive and what isn't, I'm not really, as an employee at a big four firm, I'm not really an entrepreneur, probably the furthest thing from it. So I'm not really the person to advise on that. You know, our sort of input on that would be that the Treasury needs to consult extensively with industry players and with established industry players like SAVCA. SAVCA are going to present just now on the venture capital regime and come up with creative solutions to addressing the abuse, because it can't continue. You can't allow taxpayers to get deductions for their houses and their holiday homes on the coast. I mean, that's clearly not what the incentive is aimed at. So, you know, our advice and our proposal would be that Treasury goes back, identifies what is abusive and what isn't, and then, you know, be creative in even if it goes as far back as as a redesign of the incentive, but to tailor the rules so that they're more specifically targeted at the areas of abuse. And that sounds like a cop out, but it's unfortunately, honourable, is the best I can do in my kind of position. Just as regards the CIS, is, you know, around the, you know, the perceived abuse and the perceived kind of, you know, if maybe the problem here isn't necessarily a tax issue. Maybe it's actually more of a regulatory issue. You know, if we're going to penalise people for, we're going to start taxing CISs as if they're trading every time you have a top 40 CIS, a top 40 tracker, and they have to rebalance their portfolio every 3 months, every quarter, because of the terms of their mandate, they're going to be deemed to be trading. That just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, trading, if you're going to be trading, inherently trading is a risky endeavor. And coming with, you know, what comes with this is extra return. What comes with extra return is obviously extra tax. And that is one of the basic underlying principles of the capital versus revenue debate. If you are trading and you're earning revenue, you know, the thing is that you're going to be taxed at a higher rate because you are earning more, because your risk is higher. Now, do we necessarily want our CISs to be embarking on activities that are highly risky? And my answer to that is no. So, you know, I don't know, we're coming right at the end with the tax instrument and trying to address the issue through a systemic problem in the financial services industry with a tax instrument. Now, the tax instrument is extremely blunt. The issue essentially, in my view, is more of one of a regulatory issue, where we need to go and make sure that CISs aren't embarking on risky behaviours and trading, which is not desirable.
What if a risky behaviour yields a good result? At what point do you regulate?
Well, I think that the question is more if you're embarking on risky behaviour that's not sort of investment based, you know, obviously you should be rewarded, because with higher risk should come better reward. So, you know, and with higher reward should come higher tax. I think that follows. But you know, I think the debate should be more around what is acceptable behaviour by a CIS as opposed to how do we tax a CIS. You know, I think a CIS, we should be clear that a CIS is an investment vehicle, and the regulatory regime should be such that it promotes that kind of investment attitude and that investment behaviour in the activities of a CIS. I don't know if I've answered your question.
We have this discussion because the risk appetite of CIS are not the same. If you look at how the JSC deals with risk appetite and the type of tools it has, and you look at how other countries deal with risk appetite in the investment industry is totally different. So it's an issue that we might want to come back younger at some point and clarify ourselves and agree which tool to use to try and... Because if you say don't take a higher risk appetite and yet could have yielded good results, and you say taxation is blunt, when it can be the tool that can actually deal with those who are prepared to take it. It's a discussion for another day. I don't want to prolong it. It's other presenters. Honorable.
I'm afraid, Greg, you didn't deal with the foreign income.
Yeah, I must apologize for that. There is actually, the amendment was in last year's bill, the TLAB 2017, so the amendment was in the Taxation Laws Amendment Act, there was a revised amendment, so that amendment is in place. So just cross that off the list.
Any
takers?
Other presenters?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may respond on behalf of Asisa.
Yes.
He's at the back here. So I took note of three questions, and I would like to address two of them and ask my colleague, Stephen Smith, to address the third. The three questions that I took note of were firstly around how do we deal with tax avoidance where it exists or attempts at tax avoidance. The second question was around the extent to which there was consultation. And that's the question that I'll ask Stephen to deal with at the end. And then there was a third question around elaborating on the link between introducing a higher tax for short-term gains or tax optimization versus and how that impacts the attractiveness of the CIS or the unit trust. And I'll deal with that one as well. So starting with tax avoidance where we think it exists, we do acknowledge that there are a minority of cases where it appears that individuals or families have set up CIS vehicles for the purpose of receiving favorable tax treatment or, more bluntly, tax avoidance. We think that's a tiny minority relative to the universe of CIS vehicles. More importantly, we think there are better ways to deal with that. And I'll give you one example. If there was to be regulation around requiring a minimum number of investors inside the unit trust vehicle or the CIS vehicle, that would eliminate that practice. And that's just one example. I suspect there'll be a few other examples of interventions that could be far more targeted and not harmful in any way whatsoever. I'll skip the consultation question because Stephen will deal with it. I'll go to the link between introducing a higher tax and how that makes things unattractive. And I'll cover two scenarios, Madam Chair. The first one is where, at the moment, when a unit trust portfolio manager is executing her duties, she's only driven by three things. The first is regulation. Typically, there'll be some sort of regulated asset allocation limits. The second is the risk appetite of the investors in the fund, often expressed in terms of a time horizon. And the third is the return target. What does this investor need to grow their capital by in order to be able to retire in 20 or 30 years' time? And that's all that the portfolio manager is governed by. And so all of their decisions are based on those three things. The moment you introduce the consideration of can I sell this asset given that I've only owned it for 9 months or 11 months, what that will typically lead to is a delay in the decision. And so you'll have a portfolio manager holding on to an asset which has reached what they think is fair value for that asset and should be sold. You'll have them holding on to it longer than they would have liked to. And the risk is that by the time they get to the point where they can sell it, it's that the price has fallen below the level that they would have liked to sell it. So there's a delay in decision making. The second scenario that I'd like to share with you is there are, if you look at the list of reasons why there's short-term transactions in a portfolio, that list is long. And speculation and the pursuit of profits is only one item on that list. There are many other items on that list. There's rebalances. If markets have run hard and the portfolio manager feels that they need to reduce the risk in the portfolio, there is trade in derivative instruments purely for the purpose of risk management and downside protection. All of those things would be made difficult in an environment where there's a tax on short-term gains. And I am 100% certain that it is not the intention of National Treasury to make it difficult for the unit trust portfolio manager to optimize long-term returns for retirement fund members, individual investors. That is not the intent, I suspect. And I'll ask Stephen to deal with the last question.
Well, can I ask a follow-up question? What, in terms of certainty on auditing, what will be the impact, given the fact that it should be taken into account?
Madam Chair,
saying anything, I'm just trying to understand whether is it not going to be a cumbersome process for National Treasury to audit whether some of the ventures were supposed to be revenue-orientated and not necessarily capital gains, because it, what has been deemed as a long-term investment became a short-term yield.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to make sense of it.
Sure. So if we use the example that I gave up front, Madam Chair, where let's say there's a requirement around a minimum number of investors in a CIS scheme to demonstrate that it wasn't created or registered in the pursuit of tax avoidance. That I suspect, and the FSCA is in the room, I suspect that that is something that could be required of CIS companies to report to the regulator on a regular basis. If that minimum number is 100, there's no additional work created for the policymaker or the regulator. The CIS company could be required to confirm that a vehicle that is older than, let's say, a year has at a minimum 100 investors. So there would be no burden on the regulator nor on the policymaker in terms of making sure that that is the case. Does that answer your question, Madam Chair?
No, I'm just going to remind you that Steinhoff was not reporting on his performance. We're still waiting the financial statements. Now, I'm not saying anything. What you're saying is something that is should happen on a normal basis, but here we've got a different. So they were not reporting. We're still trying to hold them accountable. You see, so I don't know. I'm not saying anything for now. I'm just showing the other side of everything. Okay, let's move to the next. Yes.
Madam Chair, honourable members, thank you. Just on the point of consultation, it needs to be borne in mind by the committee that this particular issue that is being solved for in this proposal is not coded in law or regulation in this country, and in fact in other common law jurisdictions either. So that creates by itself uncertainty. The industry is as keen as the authorities to ensure that there is certainty. The members of the CISA have to, in terms of the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, in fact, vouch for tax certainty when investments are purchased by the general public. So it is in the interest of all parties to have certainty. This uncertainty doesn't exist with respect to collective investment schemes in particular. It's something that exists across the economy. And one of the reasons why a CISA approached the Davis Tax Committee is because this has also been considered not for CISs but generally by prior commissions in prior years. And actually requires quite a bit of work to get all the facts and considerations on the table as to how this might be solved for. We do believe that there are various options. We put in a 50-page submission to the DTC. The Davis Tax Committee in their corporate income tax report dated April 2018 mentioned it and recommended that a joint technical team be put together to work on this. So that was our approach in terms of consultation. We realized that SARS and Treasury have a lot on their plate. We don't generally have any criticism of their consultation. We've had a very good history of consultation with them. They did invite us in on the 14th of May to discuss this particular point. We picked it up in Annex C of the budget in February and went to inquire about it. They called a meeting. We did not have the time to do a proper technical piece of work together. I don't know what the reason for that is. And the outcome in terms of the policy elective was given to us at that meeting. And Chair, so I think it's it might be due to a misunderstanding or a lack of time, but that's really the issue that we face on consultation. Thank you.
Well, personally, I like the idea of a technical committee. I don't want to say a lot because these people will say no, but you know, you see, you get involved in a space that is not yours. You just make the law, we put the bill on other things. But it's a good idea, so to me at least. Do you have other takers, presenters? It's your turn, Baker.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just dealing with the three matters we've been asked by Honourable East to cover, just on the tax practitioner regulation process and the comment thereof, I think the one and that proposal has been made in our submission as well. There is a two-day workshop that SARS are hosting next week to deal with the challenges regarding regulatory regime. And I think the whole issue, and I think the point you've made regarding issues, fair process, etc., I think is a point we've been making for quite some time, is that the more draconian the power, the more checks and balances needs to be in place. So if you're going to take my house or close down my tax practice, there needs to be a lot more accountability and a lot more fair procedure. If you're just going to send me a notice or audit me, there will be less accountability and procedure. But as more draconian the powers become, the more there needs to be fair procedure. We cannot rely on the same just mechanisms or no interventions, human interventions to make sure that...
What's wrong with... I want them to be friendly to you. I don't want them to give you troubles.
They're not strong. I think it's just a principle, and I think we welcome the engagement on this, and I think that's where we will discuss the matter in quite some detail. As to the explaining on the VAT, once again, there was a workshop hosted yesterday, in fact, on the challenges of the current VAT regime, but also looking at VAT, on diesel rebates and the reform thereof. And I hope that this matter was elicited at that meeting as well. So in a nutshell, this matter has been coming for quite some time. We've made submissions on this dating back to, I think, 2014. The problem is not necessarily, and the reason why it wasn't a problem in many years ago, even though in law it was a problem, was that the delays in actually getting the diesel rebate audited and finalized didn't take as long. Now, that is for a myriad of reasons, and I think that was why SARS actually called the workshop yesterday to start looking at some of those challenges, both on both the taxpayer side, but also on the system side. So in a nutshell, we've always had the diesel rebate and the VAT claim on the VAT 201 form. So the one goes off as a rebate or a payment against the actual VAT liability, which means you're actually paying less VAT than you should have. Now, once again, in the systems as we understand it, that then gets either manually or by system set off at a future date against that VAT liability. If that set off does not happen on the system, it automatically generates an underpayment. Now, the system is set up that you actually cannot pay anything different than what. So when you submit the form electronically on the SARS filing system, that is what you have to pay, but it is technically speaking the wrong amount. So once this amount is deferred due to be it audit or dispute, it then creates a VAT liability, which then itself starts triggering penalties and interest and another VAT dispute. And I think here we need to decide what we want to achieve. Do we want to have the set-off? So the reason why we've raised this as a legal issue is that, technically speaking, and the details are contained in our detailed submission, is that the customs debt is excluded from the Tax Administration Act where the set-off actually happens. So you cannot in law actually set the two off. And we either need to correct the law so that we do it, but actually match the systems then that automatically happens, and that the one then therefore doesn't create the liability of the other, or we go the other way and we separate, take the form and separate the two and have two separate processes that we deal with. David will then deal with your further examples on the dividend stripping.
Before that, younger, you'll see why my qualm with the PMA Act. You see, there's a customs element here that's delaying. And maybe people should have understood why we argue differently as this committee to have it stay here with us. It's an issue that's not in our hands anymore, you see. I don't know how we're going to solve it. But that, be it as it may, we talk to the powers that might be to. You may continue.
Yeah, with regard to the examples of where the dividend stripping override of the corporate rules is problematic, I think just to contextualize it, so we've got the corporate rollover relief rules that allow companies to reorganize their affairs without triggering tax. And that's in common with other international jurisdictions. So they've got similar rules in place. So the thinking is if everything stays within the South African taxing jurisdiction, that in certain prescribed situations one should then be able to reorganize without triggering tax. So what happened last year was that the anti-dividend stripping legislation was amended and specifically said that it overrides the corporate rules to the and that then has the effect that if one is doing what previously would have been a vanilla corporate organization transaction, now one suddenly would trigger tax because just by virtue of the mechanics of how those corporate rollover transactions work, one would fall into the dividend anti-avoidance legislation, even if all one was doing was, no avoidance involved, just restructuring the affairs as one would have been entitled to previously. And the specific examples would be Section 47, intragroup liquidations or deregistration. Section 46, unbundling transactions, and then depending on one's interpretation, possibly Section 44, amalgamation transactions as well. It's also possible that Section 45, intragroup transactions, one could also fall into that. So it was, the examples are numerous. I think that's been recognized in the bill that that's problematic because essentially the override has been, it's proposed that be deleted, but on a prospective basis, and one of the points we're making is that we think it should be retrospective because it's been problematic up to now and it should be, corrected back from then. There are situations where one could, by doing a dividend strip and then using the corporate rollover relief rules, one could achieve tax avoidance in that, and so what's come in with the current proposal is is legislation that's proposed to counter those sort of schemes. Our problem with that is that the wording of those is just so complex that it's almost unreadable.
It's exacerbated. We're trying to solve it.
And in particular, the one so-called scheme we think wouldn't make commercial sense for anyone to enter, and that's in particular the very difficult one to follow. So, we can't see a reason to actually have that in the legislation. So, yeah.
When you're unbundling, do you report to SARS so that they can look at your redesigning models and understand that it's not related to tax avoidance, but to be consistent with your operation?
Yeah, look, one would obviously one would have to fill in one's tax return, and if the question comes up about whether some sort of rollover relief provision had been availed of, one would have to indicate that in the tax return society. But, in a sort of situation where there's no attempt to then dispose of shares subsequently outside the group, etc., there wouldn't be a need really for SARS to go auditing all of those transactions. I think we understand the need why there should be anti-avoidance provision built in. It's just that we think that the wording of it is very complex and maybe unduly so and could be simplified.
Is there a specific wording that you can refer us to so that you can look at them at some point?
Well,
even if you don't make the submission now, but give us those specific wordings so that we can get
yes,
the numbers.
I'm sure we can do that.
Okay. Thank you. The ombudsperson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Honourable Mahlangu, for the clarity that you're seeking. At the heart of the Office of the Ombud, it's really confidence building in the tax administration. So anything that you want the Ombud to do, you must make sure that the Ombud is seen to be independent and not compromised in any way. So even when the office was established, the idea was to make sure that the ombud is independent and is seen to be independent and does his work and carries out his mandate independently. So, and unfortunately we are at a disadvantage because the original proposal that was made was to say with at the ombud's own initiative, not with the approval. But the approval part was obviously a compromise situation, and we never abandoned the original position. So at the end of the day, we have this situation where issues of independence are called in. And, is the ombud independent enough? Can the ombud initiate his own investigation if he sees issues that are coming from the that are arising from the taxpayers or the taxpayers are experiencing? So the pros and cons of this with being removed will just make sure that, in fact, the ombud will be much more effective because and the issue will be raised and the ombud can quickly jump into it and address it and try to find out the underlying issues causing such kind of complaints. It's not all complaints, but it's really issues of a systemic nature. So its time is of essence, in other instances, and also, if we cannot trust the ombud, I mean, for that matter, the current ombud is the judge himself, and that will regulate him and say, well, you must go and get approval before you look into this. Then maybe we shouldn't have this office. So independence is the center of this issue. And also in terms of the time it takes to obtain a ministerial approval, I think time is of essence. You don't want to lose confidence. Tax practitioners come to us, they raise systemic issues. Unfortunately, we cannot go into a thorough investigation until such time as we've obtained a ministerial approval. That on its own is a disadvantage because people look at us and they say, no, I mean, what's the point of going to the ombud? And at this stage, we are building this institution. And I must say that we will still approach this committee to refine and to try to say independence is key. At the moment, to put it bluntly, the Office of the Tax Ombud is more like a call center within SARS. That's what it is. And that's not a kind of model that you want. And so those are issues that are entangling us into independent debate. Are we independent? Are we not independent? And the kind of amendments that were introduced 2 years ago, in fact last year, were in a way to deal with the issues that can easily be addressed within the current legislation. We have gone on a route to look at the issue of independence currently, and a model is being proposed and will be discussed with the minister before it can probably be brought to this committee. Just for further refinement, we will need a fully fledged independent ombud to be able to adjudicate between taxpayers and SARS. I hope that addresses the concern.
Thank you very much. If it did not, we'll have to deal with these matters later. We've lost half an hour, so probably I'm going to be going to cut your time and the discussion in the next session. May we take the Law Society?
Let me. I'm here. Present.
Do you have a presentation or will you want to present from there?
Just wait. I can talk. I can just talk. I don't have a presentation.
Yes, you can. You can.
Thank you.
From
thank you. Morning, Madam Chair, honourable members. Madam Chair, I assume it's common cause that taxpayers should not have to pay tax on non-existent profits. I have some comments to make on the proposed amendments to Section 11J, the so-called doubtful debts allowance. Because we have an accrual system of taxation in South Africa, taxpayers are required to pay tax to the fiscus on accrued income. And that's the converse of the principle that taxpayers may claim deductions for incurred expenditure, and there's a symmetry there which is fine. The symmetry is that a taxpayer will recognize an amount of income which will come in because the taxpayer is entitled to that income, and will conversely deduct an amount which will be incurred or be payable in the future. However, it may be that the actual receipt of an amount of income may be doubtful. In an accrual system, therefore, relief should be given to a taxpayer to avoid the prejudice of paying tax but not actually receiving payment from the customer or the debtor. Inherently, granting doubtful debt relief involves making a prediction about whether a debt will become irrecoverable, because at the end of the tax year, one does not know whether or not the debtor will pay. The whole issue, in my view, about a Section 11J and where we are, is about the accuracy of predictions. So recently, Section 11JA of the Act provides a codified doubtful debt relief to a certain group of covered taxpayers, broadly banks and their affiliates. We're not here to talk about that at all. The relief that they have is an allowance which grows according to, crudely put, degrees of delinquency, from 25% to 40% to 85% for very bad debtors prior to them being written off. However, this graduated relief in terms of the proposal will not extend to a very substantial group of taxpayers, including a broad range of non-bank but very large credit providers. These credit providers, non-bank credit providers, make massive investments because their debtors are a massive part of their asset base, make an enormous investment in sophisticated technology, which enables them to predict their bad and doubtful debts with a very high level of accuracy, which is similar to the banks, and they will have to comply with the same accounting standard as a covered person, banks or similar, i.e. IFRS 9. So the current position is that the non-bank lenders currently obtain their doubtful debt allowance by engaging with the Commission on a discretionary basis. Madam Chair, this submission is not about bank versus non-bank lenders. It's purely about the fairness of the treatment of the non-bank lenders. So we've been advised by numerous taxpayers who've made some rough calculations of the impact of the proposed changes, and that is the scrapping of the Section 11J discretion. The impact, they say, will be materially onerous. In simple terms, they'll be required to pay substantial amounts of tax on amounts which they will never collect. This gives rise to a permanent and material funding cost and a permanent interest-free loan to the fiscus, which we submit is unjustified. So the fact that we have an allowance which goes in and out is a red herring. On a constant debtor's book or a growing debtor's book, there's an amount of money which will be prepaid to the fiscus. It will never come back to the taxpayer, and there's a opportunity cost or funding cost into perpetuity of making this interest-free loan to the state. Respectfully submit, there's a fundamental conceptual problem with the one-size-fits-all approach which is being adopted by the new Section 11J. The deletion of the discretion and substituting it with a straight-line 25% provision. So firstly, the amendments don't distinguish between taxpayers with different circumstances, such as how accurate their doubtful debt provisions actually are, the systems that they employ. Secondly, the straight line 25, 25, 25 doesn't take cognizance of the stages of delinquency of the debt. However, many of the taxpayer systems identify with great accuracy as debts progress through the system what the likelihood is that a particular debtor will default. So it's the same kind of methodology, I guess, that the banks are using and which is recognized in 11JA with the increasing allowance, but not applied in the proposal. So we submit Section 11JA correctly recognizes that there must be an increase in the provision as one gets more accurate information about whether a debtor is likely to pay or not. So in fact, I mean, crudely put, the proposed 25% straight line allowance, it implies that taxpayers who report under IFRS 9 to their shareholders are inaccurate 75% of the time, whereas anecdotally we've been informed by many of them that their predictions are about 90 to 95% accurate. So they know with a high level of certainty, way before debt has been written off as bad, that it will become bad. Currently, the 11J discretion allows SARS in appropriate circumstances to apply similar principles to 11JA to a broader set of taxpayers on a case-by-case approach. SARS does not have to grant a higher level of allowance to them, but SARS can, in appropriate cases, look at a taxpayer's systems and recognize the accuracy of the prediction that the amount that they have already paid tax on will, in fact, not come in. There's a further problem, which is that removing the discretion closes the door to one important method of resolving disputes between SARS and TAC and the fiscus about which debts are bad and which debts are doubtful. And this will undoubtedly result in an increased amount of litigation between SARS and taxpayers, because having a 25% doubtful debt allowance versus 100% write-off for a debt which goes bad, that gap of 75% is such a great incentive for both SARS and taxpayers to litigate over. There's just too much money involved in that difference. Whereas one can see that on the graduated basis, where it goes from 25, 40, 85%, the gap between a very doubtful debt is 85% versus a total write of 100% is nearly 15%. So it narrows the gap and therefore disincentivizes litigation. I'm sorry I've taken up so much time. I just have three. First of all, we'd like to thank Treasury for the opportunity to attend workshops, which we will certainly take up. And we have no doubt that in those workshops, attention could be given to solutions. We've made in our written submission three proposals, which we'll just briefly like to put forward. The first one would be to expand Section 11JA to these specific types of non-bank lenders, subject to appropriately being able to define how they would fit into that group. I know this is controversial, but it is one solution. Secondly, a methodology could be developed which approximates the methodology of the bank treatment, but a different treatment, not necessarily bring them into the same group, but making whatever modifications are necessary to be made for this group. And then thirdly, it might be that a hybrid approach could be considered where some kind of codified allowance is given to this group of taxpayers along the lines that we use for VAT apportionment matters, where we say, well, there's a standard method and that allows for self-assessment, apply the standard method, but allow SARS the opportunity to grant a ruling to a taxpayer in appropriate cases if there's a better way of achieving a fair and reasonable result. Until then, Madam Chair, members, we submit that the current discretionary regime should be retained until, honestly, a better solution is workshopped. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and honourable members. My submission to the Standing Committee on Finance is in respect of the change to Section 11J, the doubtful debt allowance. I just want to give some background on what mutual finance is and what we do. Our mutual finance in response to customer
needs. You must not have the advantage of time if you want to introduce the company and not go straight to the issue.
My presentation is not that long.
Okay.
So I just want to give a brief background and raise our concerns. Our mutual finance in response to customer needs decided to commence providing unsecured loans to customers during 2008, particularly customers that were unable to access funding from banks. Since 2008, our mutual finance has grown off a zero base to to employing over 3,300 people in approximately 335 branches throughout the country, with over 100 branches situated away from major urban areas. These branches offer access to financial markets and employment in towns, contributing meaningfully to the local economy. Home Mutual Finance has also plans to grow, to continue to expand its branch footprint across South Africa. Every new branch OMF opens creates approximately 7 new employment opportunities, often in communities where employment prospects are poor. These branches provide accessibility to insurance, banking, and lending services in people's immediate communities, thereby avoiding the costly need to travel to intercities to access financial markets. The branches also provide servicing to over 300,000 customers a month in relation to insurance policies, example funeral and life policies. The majority of our customers are employed in the government sector, example nurses, teachers, police, and municipal employees. Accurate affordability assessments combat over-indebtedness and are part and parcel of our mutual finances credit granting approach. Our concerns with the proposed tax change are as follows. The proposed tax treatment of non-bank lenders differs from that of bank lenders. Bank lenders would receive doubtful debt allowances of up to 85% of their impairment provisions, with non-bank lenders receiving a capped 25% allowance of their impairment provision. This means that non-bank lenders would have to pay cash taxes on 75% of amounts that have accrued to them, but which will never be actually received, only getting a tax deduction in later years. The different tax treatment is not justifiable and creates unfair competition. The effect of the decrease in the current allowance to only 25% would cause some of the branches to become unsustainable, resulting in closure and effectively taking away a legitimate financing avenue for people that are unable to acquire bank loans, and furthermore will result in job losses. A mutual finance would reconsider expanding its branch footprint, curtailing further employment and reduction in capital expenditure. The economic impact is significant at a time when unemployment rates are very high and national government is urging and incentivizing employers to create more employment opportunities. We believe that it would be fair for non-bank lenders to be taxed in the same way as bank lenders, and for the impact of the new reduced tax allowances to be phased in over 5 years so as to be affordable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Thanks for saving us time. We might need it later. Let's go to coronation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No presentation, just we'll be speaking from the back here. So, unfortunately, I have to circle the committee back to 25BA, Collective Investment Scheme tax, and a lot has been said about this, so I'll be brief. But just before I start, I'd like to recognise the presence of our regulator, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, through Ms. Kelly Dikokwe and Mr. Jurgen Boyd, that is in the room. And I'd also like to recognise my colleague, Mr. Anton Blake, a fellow executive at Coronation. The reason I'm mentioning these names is to tell you that we think this is quite a serious thing. And it is, in my 2 decades of having this responsibility, the first time that Coronation as a company would approach the Standing Committee for some assistance with the tax matter, and that should tell you that we are very concerned about the very poor consultation that has taken place on this proposal to date. Normally, it would not get to committee level, and we would be happy to leave it to a CISA to deal with industry issues. The reason why we are so concerned starts with a statutory duty of care that we have as collective investment scheme operators. So the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act in Section 2 imposes a requirement to administer...
Sorry, the problem with me, I'm not smart. If you speak that fast, I'm not going to hear.
I'll slow down, but I may ask your indulgence for about 30 seconds of the time my colleagues on the mute will save. So Section 2 of the Collective Investment Scheme Control Act asks us to administer schemes honestly and fairly with due diligence and care in the interest of our investors and in the interest of our industry. This is one of very few industries that would have a statutory obligation to not only look after your clients, but also to look after the well-being of your industry. And the reason why it works like this is because it's an industry that is designed to look after the money of other people. There are between 3 and 4 million South African individual account holders. It's households from all walks of life. And this statutory duty compels us to think long and hard about what we do and what everybody does that have an influence on the industry, and whether those actions are to the benefit or to the detriment of the unit holders of the industry. And we would hold that this very hastily crafted and very blunt tax intervention in the industry is one of those issues, and we would implore the committee to assist us by recommending to National Treasury that a due process of technical research should be followed before we make hasty changes that will be very bad for our economy and very bad, very detrimental in a very arbitrary way for a number of households. And let me just quickly explain why the issues are so significant. So firstly, we're dealing with a 60-year-old industry that have adopted a certain approach where the tax authority and specifically the tax policymaker has never deemed a collective investment scheme to be a potential scheme of profit making. It's always been understood to be a medium to long-term investment vehicle. Most funds would have recommended minimum investment periods of 3, 5, even 10 years. So there is no intent, either at scheme level or at investor level, to engage in speculative activity. It's long-term investment activity that is being conducted by the industry. And that has been the view that has been held for 60 years, I mean, until this budget in February, where in a throwaway comment with a very weak consultation process thereafter, fundamentally the apple cart has been overturned. The reason why this is so problematic is that, I mean, there is already a tax nexus that happens at instrument level, so unit trusts typically or collective investment portfolios buy bonds and shares, or equities primarily, and tax arises at the instrument level. So in the case of a bond, there's a coupon that produces interest that's taxed as income. In the case of a share, there's a dividend where there's a dividend tax. By the way, the industry very successfully, on behalf of SARS, the SARS's agent administers the collection of dividend tax as a withholding tax, so we are very prepared to help when we can and when it makes sense. So there's already a tax nexus there. There's also a tax nexus at the level of the investor, where depending on the investor's intent, their gains would be taxed as capital or income that are not annually distributed as part of the income distribution. So if the investor holds their units in their funds for 3 years or longer, it will be capital. If they don't, so I already have the ability to trade that investor as a speculator in units and collect a tax or income tax at the higher rate at that level. So what this proposal will do is it will introduce a third place where tax liability could arise, and that will be the collective investment portfolio itself. And we hold that this is quite unfair because this tax liability will have absolutely nothing to do with the investor's intent and will be unknowable. So for those of you that believe in going back to the classics in tax, there are four classic elements of tax that relate to fairness, convenience, efficiency and certainty. And this proposal fails on all four of those pillars. It's unfair because the tax liability will arise completely independently from the actions of the investor. So in the CESA submission it was alluded to one of the myriad of examples where this may happen in an instance where liquidity needs to be provided to exiting investors from a portfolio. And that may give rise to sale of securities not held for a long term, and that will leave a tax liability in the portfolio. To add insult to injury, this tax liability will not be incurred by the investors redeeming. It will be incurred by the investors remaining because it will form part of the next distribution. So we think it's completely unfair. We think it's inconvenient for the simple reason that for a significant amount of effort, you will raise relatively little additional tax. At the same time, you are going to effectively chase savings out of the formal savings pool in South Africa because, as was alluded to before, no other jurisdiction that we compete with as the local industry that are operating in the South African market have similar tax laws because other jurisdictions know to treat collective investment schemes as long-term investment vehicles, not as schemes for profit-making. And also, to make it even worse, it will make the fiscus's revenue collection more volatile because we don't always generate capital gains from capital markets year in, year out. There will be years where there will be losses. Those losses in this regime will be offset against interest income and dividend income earned in portfolios, and may extinguish that. So therefore, in tough periods, you will actually undermine the ability of the fiscus to have certainty of revenue being collected. So inconvenient for all. It's inefficient, given how small the gains will be. You also have the issue that taxes may become payable even in years where investors suffer a loss, because the instrument is so blunt that it doesn't recognize hedging activity. So in a year when a share market falls, but you have derivative contracts with a short term, and that's, by the way, how the market works. It's the only way that derivative contracts are affordable. You will make a loss on your shares, but you may make an offsetting gain on your derivative position. The loss on the shares would be deemed as capital and would not be taken into account, but the gain on the offsetting derivative would be taken as income and would increase the tax liability that the investor need to pay that year. The investor may actually suffer a loss, may have a negative return, and may end up paying a tax. The fundamental problem with all of this is that it seems like there is a misconception that collective investment schemes are something used by the elite, by the wealthy, by a select few, and nothing could be further from the truth. This is your regulated savings vehicle, authorized and regulated by government, purpose-built to look after the risk-taking assets owned by households. Something like one in every five or so households in South Africa would have exposure to this industry. And in pursuit of some alleged abuse that is debatable in itself, and insofar as it exists, may extend to maybe a fraction of a percent of the assets managed in the industry, this proposal is putting at risk one of the great success stories of South Africa's financial services industry. And really all that we're asking from the committee today is to ask your technicians, to ask your policymaker to go back to the drawing board, to engage with us in a collaborative process where we can ensure that we follow proper process, proper procedure, that we do the technical work to ensure that the system is fair to all and that we do not harm the people of South Africa and our economy at a time when it is very ill afforded. I thank you.
Thank you. Let's move to Bowman.
Thank you. So we have already heard a little bit on this tax proposal, and so I won't necessarily follow my slides exactly, but I'd like to also cover some of the issues that have come up during our discussion so far this morning. So of course we're dealing still with this doubtful debt tax allowance, and our concerns here are that at the moment we've got a discretionary allowance, and SARS has given and applied their minds to this and given various rulings, some of which are very favorable, for the very purpose that was alluded to by the Law Society of creating fairness and equity. But now, of course, this has been proposed to be replaced by a flat 25%, and it's already been raised and discussed this morning how this is going to result in one paying tax on three-quarters of amounts that you are never going to receive. So obviously that's an issue regarding fairness and also around affordability, being referred to as one of the basic tenets of a tax system. So of course, our concern are around the mismatch between the amounts of income. If you think about in debt, it's not just that you've sold something and you've now received money, it's also interest. You've maybe lent money to somebody, you haven't actually received any interest, but in terms of Section 24J of the Income Tax Act, it's deemed to have accrued to you. So you have all this amount, all this revenue that's supposed to have accrued to you that you haven't received, that you are not going to receive, and often it's very, very sophisticated models. Now, the Law Society made reference to anecdotal information regarding the accuracy of bad debts provisions. I have actually, in fact, received detailed statistical information on the back-testing of these provisions from several different clients to show the very high level of accuracy, and if anything, often these are slightly underestimated. So sometimes there's this idea that people are overestimating and trying to get extra deductions, but every time they provide for bad and doubtful debts, this makes their balance sheet look very bad, and then they struggle to get finance for their business. So no one wants to overstate these provisions. these provisions tend to be accurate, more so since IFRS 9 has been brought in. Before, they used to actually be underestimated. It's one of the reasons why, or one of the alleged reasons for our financial crisis. So people are not overstating these doubtful debt allowances. If anything, they're slightly understating them, and hopefully now these are more accurate. So as you said, the problem here is the replacement of a discretionary allowance, which could be as high as 100%, with a flat rate of 25%. Now, the Law Society spoke about unfairness and said the issue is not so much about banks versus non-banks, but I would like to specifically talk about banks versus non-banks. And one of the reasons for this is that our aspirational values as a society are contained in our Constitution, and one of these is equality. We have a right to equality of treatment. And so if there's going to be differentiation between different groups, this has to be sensible and based on the real reasons and practical realities affecting the different groups. Similarly, from a competition law perspective, we have to be very sensitive in these areas. Now, of course, there's some recent case law about competition law also binding the state. I'm not a competition law expert, I'm a tax person, but this is very important for us to be aware of, because you don't want a tax system that creates unfair competition between people who are in the same sector. And banks and non-banks are in the same sector. We, in our more detailed submissions to Treasury, we highlighted some publications where banks were claiming that they're lending more than 70% of the unsecured lending. So banks are competing with non-banks in the unsecured lending market, so they are competitors in that basis, but they're also financing the non-banks. The non-banks have to obtain their funding from their competitors, who of course will already take their margin, and now they have to try and make a business having borrowed money from their competitors, making it even more sensitive to make sure that you have fair competition between these parties. Now, Madam Chair, you did raise some questions around this and about the different regulations. Of course, we are not going to go into tremendous detail on regulations here, but what I wanted to make important points here are that there are two distinct aspects of the regulation. The banks have some regulation around being deposit takers. So that's the fact that you and I, we put our money in, as members of the public, we put our money into the banks and they have access to our capital. They've basically borrowed from us. And so they have certain regulations in terms of the Banks Act about keeping some of this money safe and set aside as capital. They've got their special capital rules so that you don't have an entire breakdown of the market of people putting their money in the bank thinking it's safe and it not being safe because it's all been lent to someone else who doesn't pay it back. So that's one aspect. That's about where they get their money from. But as regards their operation as lenders, them lending to, for example, in the unsecured market or in the secured market, as regards their lending to consumers, they are regulated by the National Credit Act and, of course, by the National Credit Regulator in exactly the same way as the non-bank lenders. That aspect of the operation is all the same. So if you're looking at the rules protecting borrowers, at all the regulations as to what you can and cannot do as a lender, those are all the same. The differences we have is only about deposit taking. So I know I've heard banks speak about, and they're concerned, they say, but we have to, some of the capital we raise, we have to now sterilize by placing it because of our capital rules. Well, the non-bank lenders don't get to raise it at all. They have to come and borrow it from you, banks, who have already placed some in terms of the bank's rules. So if you're looking at the protection of the consumer, and the actual way that your business works as a lender, the banks and the non-banks are regulated in the same kind of way. This is going to be the case as well. We've got a new system coming in with the Prudential Authority, etc. It's not in effect yet, but it's going to be the same as well. A lot of very tight regulation. Now, I know sometimes the lending industry is looked in a very unfavorable manner. People view them negatively about because of issues of over-indebtedness. And Mitchell made some comments about there. This is highly regulated. They've got special rules about over-indebtedness. But if indeed there is a concern in the legislature about these components, this should be dealt with in the National Credit Act, by the National Credit Regulator, applying to all persons, and not through some backdoor situation through the tax provision. The tax provision should be imposing tax on actual profits in a fair and equitable manner. So yes, our concern here, we have a specific extra, apart from fairness and affordability, we have concern about unfair competition and inequality in the current proposal. And then the business and societal impact. The non-bank lenders if they're going to have to pay a whole lot more tax, and that's in real rand terms, and I know that some submissions have already been made to National Treasury, that they have some idea for some of the taxpayers how severe this impact is going to be. We've had one taxpayer talking about having to close down branches, about having to lay off staff, and that's what several of our clients have indicated is a real possibility for them as well. Obviously, they're going to have to try and take some mitigating actions. So some of the mitigating actions may be that they're unable to make these loans. And I know we like to think of the fact that if people don't borrow money, then everything is fine, they don't have debt. But if people don't borrow money, then they cannot afford to pay things like their school fees, the school uniforms. These are some of the things that the non-bank lenders are helping people afford. So we have a lot of concerns here. So when we look at the likely results, the decreased availability of credit for low-income consumers, and these are the consumers who are most impacted by the non-bank lending industry as opposed to the bank lenders. It's the low-income consumers. You talk about the face of the people who are affected. The face of the people who are affected, these are the low-income consumers who will not be able to get credit. And as much as we'd like to pretend that then people would just not spend money, the reality in our market is that people will be using unregulated, unscrupulous, illegal loan sharks, etc., for their funding. And that's what we're going to be encouraging. Then closure of branches for non-bank lenders. This is a corresponding loss of employment. And, of course, loss of tax collections by the fiscus, because there won't be growth and employment. There's no employees tax then to pay. There's no income tax on the profits that are earned. So these are the things that we're very worried about. This is a very serious issue. Our proposals are that, ideally, IFRS 9 has been brought in, and I know we're not all accounting experts, but this is supposed to be a new statement that makes your provisions, your impairment loss provisions, much more accurate and in order to create more financial stability within the market. So that is the economic reality of taxpayers. We've got various areas where our accounting is a basis for our tax treatment, and this is one where you should be able to rely on it to a high degree of reliability here. At a minimum, we believe that non-bank lenders should be subject to the same basic tax regime as bank lenders. Now, I know, of course, that the banking provisions, some of it, instead of going the stage 1, 2, and 3 of the IFRS 9, it goes with the Regulation 67 things, but it mimics approximately the stage 1, 2, and 3 for IFRS 9, are the different levels of the tax allowances for banks, and there's no conceptual reason why a similar regime could not be applied for non-bank lenders. And we also believe that this should be phased in over 5 years. Now, there were questions about phasing in. We have had some other tax provisions that have been phased in. For example, some of the more recent ones will be the long-term insurers, where you phase it in over a certain number of years. We also have internationally for IFRS 9 itself and the impact of that, for example, the UK phased it in. And that is because it's going to be, if you used to get 100% of your doubtful debts allowances and now you're only going to get 25, 40, and 85, it's going to be very significant cash taxes now. And if you could say, okay, well, what's the difference here? Let's basically pay off this increased tax amount over 5 years. This would make it much more affordable, so that it's not such a shock to the industry in a single at a single time.
Thank you very much. Let's move to SAVCA.
Madam Chair, honourable members, thank you very much for giving SAVCA the opportunity to speak today. I'll just start by being the Prince now. The SAVCA is an association and public policy advocate for venture capital and private equity. Not the real home of So we have about 120 venture capital and private equity fund managers. We manage about 168 billion assets under management. And the fund managers utilizing Section 12J, which is what we get to talk about today, represents a subset of our SAVCA members. Although only 19 VCCs of the 101 as of 28th of February 2018 are SAVCA members, we represent more than 50% of the capital raised under the incentive and more than 65% of all investments made into QCs as of the 28th of February. it's a diagrammatic representation of what the incentive looks like, but I think we've discussed it enough today to go on. So has 12J been effective? SAFT is of the view that Section 12J has proven effective in raising capital from sources that would not otherwise be invested in the SMME space. It's enabled more private equity and venture capital fund managers to operate in the SMME space, bringing capital and skills and filling a much-needed gap in the market. It's a combination of the capital and skills that is the catalyst for significant economic growth. It requires a specific skill set to enable a business to successfully scale, from 5 employees to 50, and then from 50 to 500. It's also been very effective in creating new and sustainable jobs, as well as stimulating economic growth and innovation. SAFCA does acknowledge that there's an urgent need for BCCs to demonstrate social return on investment in support of the national objectives and the furtherment of South Africa's growth. We have committed to National Treasury to undertake a Section 12J impact study and provide the results to National Treasury as soon as possible. This won't just cover our members, it will be open to all BCCs. The high-level numbers that SAFCA was able to obtain as part of our submission to National Treasury was that there was a 180% increase in direct jobs created by the QCs since investment, with indirect showing an even more impressive increase. In SAFCA's 2017 Annex C submission, we requested National Treasury to consider tightening the legislation to enable the capital raised through this incentive to flow to the intended recipients and is not abused. SAFCA highlighted the potential for abuse because it was the right thing to do, and because we determined that any abuse of the legislation would pose a risk to the sustainability and the longevity of the Section 12J incentive. We highlighted this potential for abuse in the hope that we'd get proactive and interventions that would prevent a total shutdown of the incentive. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the result. The proposed amendments are very far-reaching and don't only address the perceived abuse, but threaten the existence of probably all approved BCCs.
Good afternoon. I'm going to just build on what Shirley has already started to unpack. The incentives and the amendments to the incentive have been very far-reaching, and we'd like to take this opportunity to really share with you what the ramifications of this has been, such that we can start to look at what a solution may be. Honourable Member Alfleece will be pleased to note that we have come with specific proposals which we would like to take you through. But before I do that, I would like to just share with you, I am here in my capacity as a non-executive director on the board of SAFCA, but I'm also a fund manager, and we do utilize the Section 12J incentive as a capital source. So I have first-hand experience of what is happening on the ground today. Okay, so since the release of the draft tax law amendment bill, all fund managers and all VCCs, whether irrespective of the manner in which they've been operating, have been caught within the net of the proposed amendments. So the first point to note is that this has affected all 12J members. We can share that it has been impossible since this time to be able to raise any further capital. It has also been very difficult. We find it very uncomfortable to actually deploy the capital that we've raised because of fear of falling non-compliant with the legislation once it is finally approved. We have noted in our submission, and we note here again today, that the amendment, whilst it does help to curb some of the potential abuse that Shelley has noted, is that it also captures some very strictly commercial business practices in which various share classes are used, be it at the VCC level or at the qualifying company or investee level. And we're going to walk you through that momentarily. Just before that, it is to note that the integrity of the system is really where we need to focus our efforts today. We've had investors come to us, existing investors, come and ask us whether it might be possible to get their money back. We have had investors who were due to invest later this month starting to consider not investing, which means that investments that would have been made now, which are currently underway, as well as all investments in the future pipeline, would go unfunded. We have also been reminded by our investors about the movie industry debacle. I keep getting told that I'm too young to remember this, but we have reassured our investors over the last few years that this would not be a repeat of a situation where there was a retrospective policy change that resulted in many people losing their money. One of the key considerations here is the fact that the investors in the VCCs are primarily individual investors, and many of them are retail in nature, and they have, in good faith, invested personal capital into these structures, and we are very concerned about the lack of trust that is resulting, not only amongst 12J investors, but actually amongst the broader investment community, who is looking at this as an example and saying, if this can happen in 12J, where we, in good faith, following the letter of the law, and in many instances where binding private rulings were obtained to inform these structures, that they can be retrospectively changed, then what else can happen? And I think we all know that policy certainty is an absolute underpin in terms of investor confidence, particularly in a very fragile state which existed even prior to this change. So we're here to ask for four things. The first thing that we want to ask for is an urgent review of this matter. We think we have a very narrow window to recover from the setback and to be able to regain the traction that many of our members and the broader venture capital company community were starting to gain. We also would like to then request, irrespective of what National Treasury proposes as future policy, that where the structures or funds were set up in full compliance with the legislation, that they be confirmed and grandfathered, so to speak. And we say this even in the instance where, for example, a fund manager such as our own fund may actually not be impacted by the final legislation that gets proposed going forward. Even from our perspective, just the uncertainty that would any of our investors would have that maybe the legislation would be changed again. We think it's an important message for National Treasury to send that any policy changes will be prospective only, and that any structures that were clearly abusive will be attacked under other means, be it the general anti-avoidance rule or other provisions within the Income Tax Act. The third request is that National Treasury provide a safe harbor, okay? Again, to be able to get us back on track before we lose all momentum, is to say these are the structures, and if you meet these requirements, and we have one structure that we want to propose today as a safe harbor structure, that if you fit in this, then those are not going to be under attack, okay? And we understand the commercial rationale around multiple share classes, and that is acceptable. And that anything else that National Treasury requires more time to work through, there will be an engagement process set up to do that. We would really like that the incentive is given a chance to prove itself out. Shelley has highlighted, we think there are tremendous benefits that are already flowing and expected to flow from this incentive. It has only had an uptake in the last 18 months. It is early days to start to question the effectiveness of the regime as a whole. At the same time, we go back to the fact that it is in everyone's interest, both society and business, to have tighter legislation so that there are no abusive practices taking place. That is the introduction. I am going to briefly...
It can't be the introduction. It can never be.
What I mean is that the technicalities of the proposals are included in our submission. We don't need to walk through it other than to say that we think that there is a simple structure for a pooled fund model where the scope for abuse is minimized to negligible amounts. I'm happy to discuss that if there are any questions on that. And we further note that there's an engagement process that can take place, and SAFCA is more than willing to engage and work on practical processes.
The last presenter on this round, Real People.
Okay. my presentation a little, but that's also my time won't be.
Honourable Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. This is my first visit to Parliament, and it's a rare privilege. I'll make sure I don't abuse that privilege by standing between you and a well-deserved lunch break. So, what I wish to cover briefly, getting back to Section 11J. The background has been sufficiently covered. I'd like to put that into the context of a real working example through real people home finance, compare my business and that of the industry to the banks, and finally provide some conclusions and proposals around the way forward. In fact, I think Section 11J has been sufficiently covered. One advantage of presenting last is that the technical background has been provided. I can flick through this quite quickly. Just to note, though, with reference to the slide, is that Real People has been one of the earliest adopters of IFRS 9, having early adopted this financial statement for our previous financial year. It's an incredibly difficult and complex standard to deal with, took considerable time and cost, advice from major Big Four auditing firms in achieving that. And just to point out that despite that difficulty, we've managed to implement it, whereas many banks and others are still struggling with the implementation process. And that talks to, I think, what has been covered before too, which is the sophistication, less understood, that exists in non-bank lending sectors, as it does in the banks too. Just to quickly, as I mentioned, give you a working example of how Section 11J might impact a business like Real People Home Finance. And also to provide context to what non-bank lending providers do. Home Finance is a specialist provider of unsecured finance for the buildware industry, providing borrowers who are looking to improve their homes with finance. It is a specific purpose lending. It is not general purpose lending. It can't be used for clothes, cars, or anything else. It is specifically for finance for houses. We've lent over 425,000 customers loans over the last few years, and those customers are typically customers who don't have convenient and or cost-effective finance to alternative forms of finance. They may have bank accounts, but they don't have convenient or cost-effective access to the finance afforded by banks necessarily. I've spoken to the significant underwriting, loan administration, provisioning expertise that sits in our businesses. We have credit experts, teams of credit experts who have had the same theoretical training and background as do the banks. Our objectives, very briefly, are to improve lives of South Africans through greater access to housing, building materials and services through the provision of purpose-specific housing finance. Importantly, too, what we do is we support the buildware industry in providing them access to a customer base that might otherwise be out of reach. And this is quite relevant in a time for small owner-managed stores who are finding the current economic conditions quite difficult to navigate. And finally, and importantly, we also provide a conduit for capital. The capital that was referred to by Bowman's to find a way to the housing market. And Real People ensures, although you can't see that on the slide now, that the funds are used for housing purposes. Just, I don't want to make this an editorial, so I'll flick through this quite quickly. What we do, just to provide context to term, is allow loans of up to 4 years and amounts of up to 120,000. What is important, though, is our product pricing principles, which take into account the statistical analysis referred to previously, but so to costs in originating and servicing debt, And those costs would obviously include the taxation charge. And this is the point which we wish to make. The taxation system, or a taxation system, that taxes taxpayers on income that has not been collected, or that has a high level of property ever to be collected, strains taxpayers and impacts the sustainability of the business. I think that point has also been well made by presenters before me. And again, without going into too much detail, this gives a sense of what the proposed legislation changes would have to Real People itself. As you can see, I'm not going to get into the detail unless really it's provided for in a submission we've made earlier, that the legislation as currently constituted or proposed at 25% of doubtful debt allowances would result in Real People home finders, as an example, making economic losses. Those economic losses would prevent the much needed capital we need to support the business and continue into the future. This has also been dealt with before, but I just want to summarize in a table, because I think it's very relevant and pertinent, the differences, if they exist or don't exist, between ourselves and the banking industry, which is afforded a more generous doubtful debt allowance. If I can quickly go through them, you've got the NCA, equally applicable to both. You've got the Banks Act. Yes, banks are deposit-taking institutions and therefore are required to be governed by the Reserve Bank and prudential reserving requirements. However, this is also true for non-bank lenders, not that we are subject to the Banks Act, but we have many capital and loan agreements with loan providers and capital providers that could very well institute capital adequacy requirements in excess of that required by the banks. Real People, as an example, needs to maintain capital of at least 20% of its asset base, which arguably is more conservative than that required by the banks. Funding, yes, banks do have various forms of funding, including access to deposits and hence the governing regulations. We seek our funding through banks, as described before, and in the capital market. And that funding cost is likely to be more expensive than that which is provided or accessible by the banks. The types of lending, banks are mainly unsecured. Of course, they do a significant amount of unsecured lending too, but as a proportion of their total book, their preponderance would be skewed significant towards secured lending, whereas ours is mainly in the non-bank sector, developmental and unsecured. Therefore, the credit losses one would expect, given a higher risk business without security, to be higher than on average one would expect across the book in banks. And finally, on the slide, accounting standards. IFRS 9 has been spoken to. IFRS 9 came about in response to, amongst other things, the financial crisis. It has an intent to provide an accurate and economically truthful position of a company's balance sheet. And as I've said, we've already adopted that through detailed statistical analysis, and which back tests well and has stood up to the scrutiny of external audit. In summary, the tax allowance for doubtful debts is determined with reference to the accounting treatment. So I'm just going to read off my slide for this one. And the same IFRS standards regulate the accounting provisions for both banks and non-bank lenders. And the same auditors, using the same statistical processes, sign off on both. Insofar as capital, both have capital regimes, albeit one is set by the SAR and the other by the capital providers or funding structures. Therefore, there is no reason for differentiation. Non-bank lenders lend proportionately more to the unsecured market. Consideration, therefore, needs to be given to whether the percentages proposed in Section 11JA, even if allowed for non-bank lenders, would be adequate, or, let's say, a requirement, or should there be a requirement for a new Section 11JB, for instance, that deals with specifically with non-bank lenders. Real People, as a business, would welcome a thorough consultation process. And in order to determine the most appropriate allowance for non-bank lenders, with particular reference to developmental credit providers. Were the draft legislation as currently proposed enacted, the outcome would impact the sustainability of the Real People business and other developmental credit providers, whilst providing an unfair advantage to the banks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honourable members, it's open for discussion. So,
questions? Any taker? Honorable Liz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've covered the same sort of ground a number of times, and so I think it's quite clear where the concerns lie. And so, in a sense, I just want to say that when I challenged Erica about whether I agree or not, there's a principle here as opposed to just the phasing in. Phasing in is like a side issue in my view. The main issue is the question of whether it's fair and just in the first place. So I wasn't terribly contrary to what you were saying. I was just trying to get to the core of what I see as the core of the issue here. And then phasing in would be, I think, secondary, but you can correct me if you wish. But there's a penalty to pay just about lunchtime. You could buy me lunch. Now, that might be considered bribing. Madam Chair, I withdraw that.
Are you asking for a bribe daylight?
Gratification. Yeah. I'll have to buy Erica lunch. So that was the one point. I'm not sure that David's going to say anything, but I think it's...
Nobody ever buys me lunch.
No. I think that the real people presentation does give one a sense of what the market does can provide, so I found that very interesting. But the points made, of course, were good points and fell in line with the other presentations. So. Yeah, nothing more.
Any other member? Well, I've got some few questions. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I need to leave at some point. Let me start with the Law Society. You're saying that National Treasury should take into account stages of delinquency of a debtor, but you didn't outline at what stage should they do that.
So perhaps you might want to make a suggestion. You also said they must look at taxpayers. I'm not sure how you want them to look at that without doing an expensive tender and audit and other standards different. So maybe you can explain. But you also said there should be a hybrid system, and particularly relating to self-assessment. Self-assessment?
You said collective investment schemes are not engaged in speculative activities. Is it a matter of fact? Can it be put to test? There's no any other collective investment scheme that has been involved in speculative activities. I'm asking this because I don't want to find a situation where the CIS is being subjected to penalties by National Treasury because there was an over-observation about how they conduct their business. Maybe you speak on behalf of those that you represent, necessarily in terms of their moral conduct, but I'm not saying anything, I'm just asking so that as we take decisions we are clear that it won't happen. And every time when you speak about all these things, I just remember African Bank, I remember Steinhoff, and then I ask myself, do we have the same morality, all of us? And so on. Secondly, you said that the collective investment portfolio might trigger a tax liability. Can you demonstrate it to us so that we can understand from what you are dealing with? Also, on the issues of the derivatives versus the falling share prices, I would want you to even if it's not today, just the pager that explained to us, because today we don't have the advantage of time to deal with all these things here. In terms of performance, I want to know the accuracy of the beds and the data that is being put forward, whether has it been tested before, so that we understand that, as you say, that you will not be able to recover that money. That matter has either been tested in terms of its accuracy. Whether they are understated or overstated, can we get some examples? And I think National Treasury, when they respond also, they must come to a point where they say, based on experience, there's been overstating of the debt book by people before, so that we understand where we are. I don't know why, but I have many questions. I'm sorry. I'm going to come to Safkat. The first lady who spoke said capital that has been received through incentives must be channeled to those who are entitled, which is SMEs. In this context, we're given figures that it has not been. So maybe you might want to tell us how we can do that, so that we don't rely on the tax instruments to address what has not been done through the incentive scheme. To real people, two last questions, and this is the ones, when you're speaking in good faith, I got worried because you were speaking in good faith. You see, when you speak about accurate statistical balance sheet, then I remember Steinhoff that day. That these are the people who gave the wrong balance sheet to the very same auditors. And when you're speaking about auditors, then I remember that we are advocating for mandatory rotation because auditors in South Africa has been found wanting. So these are the people that you can't rely on anymore. So you can't refer to auditors because here in South Africa we've got the KPMG experience and so on. We still have a lot of investigations about the conduct of auditors. That's why I will remember when I was advocating for mandatory rotation what I said. And people, accountants were not very happy. But when they were caught, they are not coming back to us to explain themselves, you see. We knew it will happen at some point. So I'm not so sure. Let me stop there because we don't have time, Yanga. Because we're already at 1 o'clock and I don't know how far we can go and how much of we can give you time, but let's, members, I'm asking you for indulgence. Let's give the presenter 15 minutes and give Yanga and Chris and the team 15 minutes. Chris, we'll leave at 1:30. Thank you very much. This doesn't have to be a priority. Anybody who's ready to respond, yes, we may.
I just want an opportunity just to clarify one or two things that's raised. At the beginning,
you are not audible, you need to speak into the mic.
Oh, sorry. Sometimes at the beginning, Madam Chair, you requested clarification on tracker funds. I thought I didn't see anyone clarifying, so I thought I would clarify it for you. So a tracker fund, and I'll give a simple example. Let's just say the top 10 of the JSD, and let's just say each one of them are 10%, that makes up 100% of a CIS fund. It's tracked in the top 10. And then you invest equally in all of those, in equal 10% of the portfolio assets in those shares, in that index, making up. When that index starts changing, so one becomes 12 and other goes down, etc., you have to rebalance. And in that rebalancing, you're going to sell some and you're going to buy. So, and that's the issue that was raised in the selling, when you're rebalancing, that's when you could trigger a situation where the tax is coming through. So that's the one I sort of want to clarify for you. The other thing, Madam Chair, you raised a concern about sign-off and the failure to provide financials, and I thought you questioned the CIS, and I just wanted to clarify that totally different investment vehicles. Sign-off is a company set up under the Companies Act, subject to the Companies Act, listed on the stock exchange to the extent that it was secondary listed, subject to the exchange and the listing requirements of the stock exchange, whereas the CIS set up under the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act, with strict regulations around it, as to you've got a manager of a CIS who is, as was alluded to by coordination, needs to comply with specific legal requirements in exercising its fiduciary a mandate on behalf of investors. Part of the structure is that we require a trustee, it's normally a corporate trustee, one of the big banks, to set up a trustee business, and all the assets of the CIS under the control of the trustee. The manager will direct where the assets are invested, for example, in terms of the mandate of the portfolio, totally separately managed or held by the trustee on behalf of the investor. So the issue you may have a concern about financial assistance is totally different. The CIS portfolio, within 3 months after this financial year end of the portfolio, they have to serve the financial class as a regulator. And in the 20 years I've always been, almost been at the FSCA, we've never had a problem with the CIS. There's never been the sign-off or potential abuses in the industry. So totally, totally different industry, as was alluded to, well regulated by last year. As far as the proposed chair, I just want to put my 2 cents worth in as representing the conduct regulation on behalf of investors. Our view of this proposed amendment and how the impact on CIS is that we're going to we think work needs to be done between ourselves, industry, and National Treasury to fully unpack what their concerns are. PwC alluded to the fact that there is regulation. If we find any manager of a CIS trading, short-term trading, with the intent of making short-term profits, the Act allows us to take action against that manager, because that manager will not be complying, first of all, with its legal requirements, and secondly, with regard to the mandate of the portfolio that where the short-term trading or short-term gains has taken place. That's on the pharmaceutical side. And then the managers normally outsource the management of a portfolio to investment managers.
Sorry, is it possible that I can cut you short so that I can have the presenters to respond first? Because this is the conduct authority. You should have been engaging each other somewhere else. I'm very worried.
We have engaged.
No, I'm worried about what's happening here. I was expecting the...
Madam Chair, if I may just conclude on the collective investment issue, if you will allow me.
Yes, I want the presenters to be the ones to respond.
So very briefly, I have to respond to Jan Keda. I mean, she may think that we consulted. We have not. So can we just put that on the record? Yeah. Okay.
Let's have a dialogue on the issue of consultation.
So
we will come to it as a committee. The committee has noted its members have listened to all the presenters who have raised a challenge with consultation. We will come to it when we are sitting as members. Let's respond to the questions, and then any other matter that has been raised as a concern will be addressed by the committee. And also will afford National Treasury an opportunity to respond when they're responding on the issues that you have raised on consultation, so that it doesn't become a trend show for now, but deal with specific issues that have been raised.
So maybe, Madam Chair, if you'll allow me, I'll just quickly conclude on the collective investment related issues. So you've asked if it's a matter of fact that CIA portfolios cannot be a scheme for profit making. So clearly in the South African context, that's not a matter of fact. This is a matter of dispute. The fundamental concern that we have is that in virtually every other jurisdiction and all the competing jurisdictions, specifically in the European Union and the UK, this is a settled matter of fact. Tax authorities and regulators do not treat CIS schemes that are designed as regulated broad public investment vehicles. We have a myriad of different investors and a myriad of different objectives. It can never be regarded as a scheme for profit making, and it's been codified in law as such. So in South Africa, that has been the de facto approach over 60 years of the history of the industry, but it's never been settled law. It's always been a controversial matter. So the one benefit that we can obtain through this process is to once and for all settle this uncertainty and put this issue to bed. So this is a very constructive process. The second question that you've asked about morality, I think Mr. Boyd did deal with that to some extent with regard to the regulatory framework. But all I will say to that is we are as concerned as the chair and the committee members are in terms of some of the issues that you've expressed with regards to morality in the private sector, corporate behaviour, and we wish you all the best in pursuing those that are guilty. From the private sector perspective, we are doing our little bit through the civil litigation processes, but I think we're on the same side on that one. And with regards to derivatives, we're very happy to augment our technical submission to explain how typical hedging transactions work. Why that is a very pertinent example to us is we typically use those types of derivative instruments or hedging strategies to modify the risk profile of investments to be suitable to low-risk investors, and that very often are pensioners or retirees taking an income from their portfolio that can't afford significant levels of market variability or volatility in their returns, and therefore, and effectively to manage the sequence risk or catastrophe risk against a very significant market decline. I mean, that's often how you would use these. And that was the situation that I was alluding to, but we'd be very happy to submit more detail on that. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker.
Madam Chair.
Do you mind if I, becomes unfair and take the lady?
Of
course. So you're asking about the accuracy of the digestion. This is something that I don't...
Your microphone.
Can you use the next one? This is something that... We've been representing the large non-bank lenders association and certain other clients on these points. And of course, there's quite a lot of concern about sharing sensitive commercial information and the competition law provisions. So everything's been coming through centrally to us. We've started already collecting data on the accuracy of bad debt provisions, looking at it historically. Certain members have been able to give us more long-term information, some only the last 3 years, some longer, but everything we've seen so far has been that these are highly accurate. So far we're seeing the same kinds of numbers, probably saying kind of 90-95% accuracy in slight understatement. So it isn't quite as well provided as it should have been, which is also something we would have expected given that IFRS 9 is fairly recently, it's not compulsory, it's only starting to be compulsory now, and it was especially brought about because impairment provisions weren't large enough in the past, or so it's alleged. So that's consistent with what we would expect, that in the past these have been accurate, but not quite as high as they probably should have been, and in the future hopefully they'll get to closer to 100% than only 90%, as high as they should be. But this is absolutely, all the data we've seen so far shows these are accurate provisions and reliable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your question relates to the credibility of our external advisors, I guess, and I must admit somewhat cynically I was talking to my colleague alongside me this morning wondering whether I should even mention the audit firms. To make matters worse, Deloitte are our external auditors and KPMG are our internal auditors. So we've certainly picked them. What I can say to you, though, is that I will vouch for their analytical and teams, their financial services, institution services team. The work that they did on our provisioning, albeit a fairly small company, was incredibly significant.
The cost to us, unfortunately, was also incredibly significant, running well into, you know, into many, many millions, certainly with the adoption of IFRS 9. What I can also vouch for say is that they independently calculated provisioning, not just checked our calculations, but put our numbers into their big machine, and came out with a result very similar to what we did, independently corroborating the outcomes. What's also also I think equally important is the following, is that from our implementation back in March 2017, what is important is to track, if you will, the cash flow projection, what you expect to receive in cash versus what you actually did. And again, I'll talk to what Patricia has just raised in with regards to the accuracy. Ours is tracking at around 99% over the last 15 months in terms of what we predicted at the time versus what we actually did receive. Last point I will make is that if there is any concern, cynically otherwise, and then I'm open to it, around the audit firms, we'd welcome any other interrogation from any other body, be it Treasury, be it SARS. Everyone's welcome to come and check out the methodologies. They're statistically sound. It sounds complicated. Ultimately, it's not rocket science. It's stuff that can be independently verified and audited, using tertiary educational training. We employ many of these people, and we'd only be too pleased to engage with anybody interested in checking out the authenticity or accuracy of our numbers. Thanks very much.
Thank you. We still have 2 minutes.
Madam Chair? Mayor? Law Society? Oh, did I interrupt? I'll take it back. I'll take the last minute then.
Thank you. The question was whether the majority of capital has not been going to the intended beneficiaries being SMEs. I'm not aware of data that suggests that that is the case. As far as we're aware...
We want National Treasury to listen to this one.
And if there is data, we'll have a look. But to our knowledge, the vast majority of capital that has been raised and deployed has gone towards SMEs and certain priority sectors that we understood to be the focus of this, being hospitality, manufacturing, and junior mining. So I think that we would need to understand that data, but that's not the data that we're aware of. We highlighted the potential for abuse, and I think that is the important thing. We are not aware that this has been abused in any material respect to date. We were concerned that it would have the scope for abuse. We became aware of structures that were being marketed, so we are not aware of who may have implemented those structures, only what was being marketed, and we did not want that to compromise the rest of what we believe to be the intended purpose. But on that matter, it is unclear what the intended purpose is. And in the absence of further clarity, we can only assume, given the legislation, given the binding private rulings, and given the recent draft tax law amendment bill, what it is that National Treasury is unhappy with. But we have never had that clear communication.
All right, thank you. Law Society?
Madam Chair, you had three questions. I can deal with the first two in one, namely this point about stages of delinquency and accuracy of taxpayer systems and auditability. Most of the large companies that I've been exposed to in practice utilize externally developed international software, which is used to categorize their debtors into numerous buckets, not just the three which are mentioned in Section 11JA, but many, many more as they move through the continuum of being good to ultimately so bad that they must be written off as irrecoverable. But despite the fact that there is very granular level interrogation of the debtors, which is available because these systems are quite commonly used, Section 11JA, I haven't heard anybody complaining that the three buckets that it contains don't work, and therefore why reinvent the wheel? Just the point on that. Secondly, in terms of the taxpayer systems, the ones that I've seen, as my colleagues have also said, are back-tested. So there's data available, historical data, to show that in the past they operated accurately and they tweaked to make sure that they continue to operate accurately. I assume that would be auditable by SARS and would give a high level of comfort, irrespective of relying on the audit profession. The types of companies who have spoken to us about this concern are concerned about reporting accurately on their profits to their shareholders. It's the board of directors who's reporting on their profits, and a life and death factor in these huge credit providers who have billions of rands on their books is getting these provisions correct. The auditors do their own work, but I don't want to stand or fall on the rigor of that work, although that's been spoken to. And then thirdly, this idea of the hybrid system. I don't have any mandate from any of the other commentators in this room, but to me it seems very important that unless and until we get this right, we should retain some measure of the discretion so that in appropriate cases we can make the right adjustments. Thank you, Manager.
Thank you very much. Yanga and your team, your opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond on TLAB issues and SARS will respond on TALAB issues. In terms of statistics, while the matter is still fresh, on the VCCs, SAVCA, maybe they can say how many VCCs are under them, but in terms of the statistics as of 28 February 2018, there are about 103 VCCs approved by SAV. 2 billion invested in the VCC, but only 500,000 invested on qualifying companies. So only about
statistical fact.
Yes, it's a SAV. So they are regulating some of the VCCs, but the VCCs we have in the system as of 28 February, meaning that only 29% of the amount invested in VCC goes to qualifying companies. That is the statistics we have. So, okay, that is what we have on the SAV, like in terms of the statistics, on all the VCCs that are approved by SAV. So that is another myth. So secondly, in the abusive structures, in closing the abusive structures of VCCs, we have received the comments, and as we normally do, we take comments into consideration. And when we do the response document, we're going to have workshops on the 4th and the 5th of September. When we do the response document, we're going to say clearly where is the legislation going to change based on whether the legislation has gone too far. We have done that in the previous cases. So this is what we're going to do also in the VCC. And then the second issue is the collective investment schemes and the issue of consultation. Before the budget, we met with Jagan from the FSCA regarding the issue of collective investment schemes. That was before the budget. And the issue went into the budget proposals for 2018. Unfortunately, in the budget proposal, we said there is an abuse, we're going to close the abusive schemes. We didn't say how. So in doing our how, on the 20th of April, we met with members of ASISA to discuss the how. And then again, on the 14th of May, we met with members of ASISA to discuss the how.
This ASISA,
we've got the date. On the 20th of April, we met some, and the 14th of May, we met some. And as we normally say here, we put out the proposal, and the proposal that we have on the table is the proposal that was set out also by ASISA on the four options on the paper to DTC on the date of 20th November 2017. But we understand that proposal is not without problems. So if they come here on the comment stage with the problems, we understand also the problem of tracker farms, and we understand that clearly because that is the issue we're going to deal with. So each and every proposal, even on their paper, this one proposal we have chosen was option three on the DTC submission dated 20th November 2017 by ASISA, and then they listed all the problems. So we move on with the proposal, and then we're going to identify the problems and try to assist with the problems. And they've admitted here to say there is a minority of abuse, so how do we go about closing the abuse? So we hear them, we understand that there are other issues of legitimate businesses where the tracker funds issue, of which also the balancing of tracker funds, we understand that issue clearly, that it's legitimate. So we will deal with that issue on the response document. And there is a third issue, that is the bad debt allowance. Last year we made proposals regarding to banks, and we met with the Reserve Bank, and then the banks are highly regulated because of capital liquidity. I wish to state here that there is a bad debt allowance, and then when the debt is bad, there is a write-off. It's not like the income tax does not do anything about bad debt. There is a bad, doubtful debt allowance, and then there is a bad debt whereby you can write off. That said, we hear their comments, we're going to have workshops on the 14th and the 5th, and on the response document, we're going to respond. And as you normally do, at least you've been here for the past 5 years, there are issues whereby we have, you said, younger, go back and do this thing again. We've done that on the debt relief rules. We've done that on the dividend stripping rules. And even on the CFC rules, we've done that. So with our, as I've said with ASISA, when they say that we should not write this proposal into legislation, I said our mandate is to write the proposal into legislation. Parliament will say retract. It's Parliament that will tell us what to do. We cannot say because we've had meetings with you, we're going to retract the proposal. It has to go out, and then Parliament will tell us what to do. So now the matter is in Parliament, and then we are doing the proposal. And then on the issue of the tax ombuds, we've met, the issue is not on the 2018 budget proposal, nor the issue is on the 2018 draft TLAB. I want to put that on record. But we have had several meetings with the tax ombuds regarding the issue of the autonomy of the tax ombuds and all the issues regarding to the autonomy. We are dealing with those issues. We've had several meetings with them even before today. We had meetings like, I think, in early August or end of July. So we are dealing, because this issue of not with the approval of the minister, it goes with the whole issue of the autonomy of the tax ombuds. So we are dealing with those issues. I don't know whether Chris will want to say something or else we hand over to SARS.
Very quick, please. I'm running out of time now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Only two issues from the TLAB. I mean, obviously, we look at the written comments as well, where more issues arise. Just on the audit engagement letter, thank you. Sides, we take the point that we should be consistent and use the notice of commencement description, which is what we use elsewhere in the Act. Obviously, on the gobbledygook source communications, we have committed to ensure that that really is enhances filing season. Obviously, automation is a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing if you try to issue standard letters when you should be issuing specific letters. It sort of reminds me of what Judge Davis once said, that the difference between a lawyer and an accountant is you can substitute an accountant with a good software system. So it may be a good thing that SARS can't be fully automated. So that's a good thing that our copy should be automated, and including writing letters, otherwise we won't have work. Just on the deregistration of tax petitioners, SAICA, we note that yes, there will be field procedure that always applies, but is not excluded, nor will be excluded. What happens to clients of these tax petitioners? I mean, obviously, if they've been repetitively and continuously non-compliant, it might be time to look for a different tax petitioner. At the end of the day, the regulation of tax petitioners is there to protect taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, I can't give you more time. The chairperson, I think, where he is watching me. He's going to kill me when he comes back. It never happens in this committee that we stretch until this time. As the acting chairperson, I need to thank you for making my work very easy. The chairperson will be back next week. Unfortunately, I need to rush because I'm a duty whip in the house. So this brings us to the end of our discussions. Those who are not satisfied with the answers and the engagement, this is not the last engagement. As you know, this committee always gives you the opportunity to engage and engage, and we'll engage on written submissions if there are any or written responses. And I take it that by the time we come to the end of our discussions, we'll have tried very hard to reach out to many of your submissions. So thank you very much. I apologize. We need to close the meeting. The meeting stands closed. Thank you.